Hey everybody, we're back. Nate is not here. Dan and I have not recorded in 6 months, and I have apparently forgotten how to podcast. And that might be apparent through this episode, so please be gentle with me. But we are here. This is our love letter to one of the great actors of our time, mostly known for cinema work, but we are going to talk today about Charles Bronson's television career. That is the topic. And to do that, I brought on a guest in lieu of Nate, who I don't think is even a huge Charles Bronson fan. So it's probably better that we have our friend James Newton here. Hey, James, how are you doing?
Hey, Jim. Thank you both. Absolutely delighted to be here. And I just want to say thank you before we go on that you've introduced me to these films and television programs that of Charles Bronson's that I'd not seen before. So I'm really looking forward to talking about it and giving my thoughts. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you know what? I haven't seen any of these either. And am I right, Dan, that you haven't seen them
None of them.
either?
I didn't even know that the movie we're going to talk about was a thing that existed. I was very surprised when you sent it to us.
Well, I'm happy to say, well, let me tell you what we're showing and then I'll tell you a little story that's not that good. That'll take two sentences about the
Can't wait
film.
to
So instead of
hear
doing two TV movies, we decided to do two shows that Bronson appeared in, two episodics. And one TV movie. And I did that because he didn't do a huge amount of TV movies, and also because he did a lot of episodic work at the beginning of his career. So we decided to do Man with a Camera, the pilot episode, which is actually the only TV series that Charles Bronson actually starred in. I think it's like 29 episodes. It didn't run for a super long time. It's in public domain, I think. It's available everywhere. So if you're listening and you want to watch it first, you can find it on YouTube or on Tubi, probably on Amazon, and I believe it's on DVD as well. And we're also covering a One Step Beyond episode titled The Last Round, which I'm really excited about. I'm a huge fan of One Step Beyond. If you want some background on that, I probably won't go too deep into it. But we discussed the host of One Step Beyond, John Newland, very early on in this podcast when we did, I think we did Crawl Space and Don't Be Afraid of the Dark together, and he directed those. He would go on to become a really prominent television movie director and producer, one of my favorite filmmakers. And he's the dapper host of One Step Beyond. And then we decided to go jump ahead towards the end of his career into the 90s, a little after his wife Jill Ireland died. He came back and he worked predominantly in TV after that. And in 1993, he made a movie called Donato and Daughter with Dana Delaney and Xander Berkeley. And so I've had this movie, my stupid story, it's not even a story. I've had Donato and Daughter on VHS for years, under its VHS title, Dead to Rights. But I always thought it was associated with, so at the very, very end of Charles Bronson's career, he did a trilogy of TV movies called Family of Cops. And I assumed it was part of the Family of Cops series, but I just wasn't sure where it fell into that timeline. And because I hadn't seen the first Family of Cops yet, I hadn't watched it. Well, it turns out it's a totally separate thing. Although I guess it's a family of cops, actually, in the story, so that's kind of funny. But so we decided to just pay tribute to him because on November 3rd, our beloved Bronson would have turned 100, and I'm actually surprised he didn't make it because I've never seen anybody quite that buff before in my entire life. And I guess it pays to work in coal mines at 8 years old or whatever. Before we go into that, I just wanted to, usually we do the shameless self plugs at the end, and I'll talk about some stuff I've worked on at the end, and we can talk about your guys's podcast when we get there. But I wanted, you guys have a lot of great stuff happening. And so I wanted to start with James. I think last time you were on, which was a while ago now, you were in the process of finishing up your book, The Mad Max Effect, but that's out now, is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, it's out Bloomsbury in hardback. So it's very, very dear. So if any listeners out there have access to a university library, you can order it through that, and it may well be in your university library already. Other than that, it'll probably be a few months before the paperback is out, which is obviously far more affordable. But yes, technically, the Mad Max Effect is out.
Yay.
You can read it, and I don't have to do any more work on it. So
I
that's
know
very
the feeling.
comforting. Yeah, it's all good.
Tell us a little bit about the book, just so people know what they're, I'm obviously the title kind of gives it away, but give us a little bit of insight.
Essentially, it's for a book series called Global Exploitation Cinemas. And each of the books in the series, obviously, I'm just contributing one of the volumes, is on a different chapter in exploitation film history. And I really wanted to look at the films that Mad Max inspired in the 1980s, which I know that Daniel's a fan of as well. The book really is the narrative of what Mad Max was inspired by, what Mad Max ended up being, and then what Mad Max inspired. So it really looks at the post-apocalypse road warrior style movies that were released after 1981 to about 1993. But it really tells the story of the way Mad Max developed aesthetically, how that emerged out of the biker movie, out of the revenge film, and out of the Australian exploitation industry in the 1970s, and how it spawned this transnational, international, huge amount of post-apocalypse road warrior movies that rip off and pay homage to Mad Max. So and I kind of center it at the heart of this kind of tradition of exploitation culture that hasn't really been looked at too deeply in academic terms. But
Awesome.
there's been a lot of fan stuff around it and excellent stuff which I drew upon for writing my book. But I wanted to just take a little bit more of an academic eye on that journey of the post-apocalypse road warrior movie.
That's so great. And I'm not as familiar with Mad Max as I should be, but I know I have seen Fury Road. I actually haven't seen the other three, which I feel horrible about. My mom was a huge fan of them because she was from Australia. So I don't know how I particularly missed it, but I do know that that era of like that sort of it's and it's not even like so I could be wrong about this in where I'm taking this, but like just when you're talking about aesthetics, like it fed into everything. Like when you think about like how the warriors looked, even though that's not necessarily a post-apocalyptic film, although I guess it feels that way to some degree, it feels like it fed off of this kind of genre to me. Would you say that too, James, or do you think I'm
Yeah,
totally
absolutely. So that was the same year as the first Mad Max. And I think what I talk about a little bit in the book is the idea is it kind of just tapped into this post-punk zeitgeist that was happening internationally. So it's not, I'm careful in the book to say that, Mad Max is not the centerpiece for all of this stuff. And if you take the Italian films that were made in the mid-80s, like Bronx Warriors and Bronx Warriors 2, they are riffing on both Mad Max, The Warriors, and Escape from New York, because they're set in New York, right? So it's a mix of all those three things. So it's difficult to separate. And the way that the aesthetics of Mad Max draws on this post-punk new wave style costuming and things like that, The Warriors is very much a part of that zeitgeist as well. So I talk a little bit about that, and The Warriors gets mentioned a couple of times.
I thought I was making a total ass of myself, so that worked out really
No,
well
no,
for
you
me.
weren't. You weren't.
And aside from that, you also, I think you had just finished Black Lizard Tales, or it was going to be screening at CineXS. I can't remember, but you have a distributor for that now, is that right?
Yes, I do. That's in that should be coming out on a Blu-ray release by Darkside Releasing in early 2022.
Okay.
So
Congrats. That's awesome.
yeah, it is. Yeah, that's the that's that, so that's quite exciting. And it was a long time ago I finished it, so I'll be looking forward to looking at it again because I haven't watched it in a while. So yeah, that should be Darkside Releasing. They release it's a boutique label. They release so many great low budget, micro budget horror films and action films, including quite a lot that were made in the UK, even though they're a Canadian company. And it's just really exciting to be part of that. So I'm looking forward to that release. Yeah, it should be hopefully January or early February next year.
Great, that's fantastic. And it's a really great film. So I hope everybody's listening. Write that down somewhere and remember to
Oh,
check it
thank you.
out. Yeah, I
Thank you
loved
very much.
it. It's got some really jarring imagery in it that I remember watching it late at night. I sat on my bed, I watched it on my computer, I had all the lights out, and there was some definite like verbal gasps for me from some of the there's some really good scares in it. It's a terrific little horror film. I loved it.
Oh,
So,
thank you very much.
yeah,
Thank you.
sure. And you have a new film, is that right?
Well, yeah, in the summer I wrote with my colleague of mine, Paul Richards, who's in Black Lizard Tales. I've collaborated with him loads and loads of times. We kind of co-wrote this. I don't even know how you begin to start, really. Is it a horror film? Is it a comedy? I don't really know. But we wrote it in about 3 weeks and shot it in about, I think, 8 days. And that's a feature film that I'm just starting to edit now. And it's a kind of surreal nightmare escape. Comedy is the best way that I can describe it. If you ever invite me on again, I should be near enough finishing and I'll be able to give you a better understanding of what the plot line is. In fact, I don't even want to tell you what the plot line is at this point. But yeah, it's exciting, and it was really fun to make, and I'm looking forward to developing my style and putting the finishing touches to that. But I don't fully know how it's going to turn out right now. But it's exciting. It's exciting.
Oh, great. Well, all your stuff is so good. So, be looking forward to seeing that when you get it to the point where you're willing to show it to people.
You're very kind. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. I love your stuff. And then Dan also, a labor of love. This book is like how it's like 3 freaking pounds of
Three and a half
awesome.
pounds, yeah.
Three and a half pounds of awesome. I don't even know how many ounces that is. It's so many ounces. I can't even do the math. So, like, you wrote a book called From Beverly Hills to Hooterville, Exploring TV's Henningverse, 1962 to 1971. 9 brief years, 3 pounds of material.
Yes.
So, this just came out, right? Just in the last month or so,
It
is that right?
was, yeah, in the past a month and a half or so, there was a brief period where I didn't tell anyone about it because I wanted to get a copy and I wanted to make sure it looked good. So,
Sure.
yeah, so about a month, say about a month.
So I know you've talked a little bit about it, but go ahead and tell everybody why there's 666 reviews and why we shouldn't be terrified to have that in the
You
book.
should, yeah, well, I'm sure there's probably someone who's going to see that there's 666 reviews and not buy it. But that's 222 reviews of Petticoat Junction. That's one third exactly. 170 reviews of Green Acres and all the rest of Beverly Hillbillies. So it's all 666 episodes of those three shows from the first episode in broadcast order, from beginning to end. And so we start with the Hillbillies in 1962 when the show immediately became the number one program in America for 2 years, till 1971 when Petticoat Junction was gone. All in the Family had taken over the airwaves, and Beverly Hillbillies and Green Acres were looking a little strange. Although Green Acres was still funny to the end, and Beverly Hillbillies, they just decided to get really weird in the last year of the show. And I just go through all 666 episodes, and it's sort of a, it's a cumulative journey. And I bring that up because I've met a couple Henningverse gatekeepers online who
Oh, of
are
course.
having some trouble. They're generally white guys about 20, 25 years older than I am, with strange questions and no patience. And you begin at the very beginning, striking oil and moving to Beverly Hills, and then you just proceed through episode by episode, and it's cumulative. So you grab on all this information as you go, and then when all three shows are going at once and they're beginning to cross pollinate with one another, which wasn't something that was really done at all at that time. It becomes more and more interesting. And plus, because it covered that time period, it's such an interesting time period in American history
Yeah.
that they bring in, I mean, it's women's rights. Now, granted, that generally sometimes generates into very strange women's lib episodes, but you get the beatniks at the beginning, you get the hippies at the end, you get all sorts of everything that happened at that time period is touched on it. Well, not everything. You know what I mean.
Yeah.
A lot of things. It touched on at some point or other in one of the three shows, and I bring them up, and we develop the characters, and I give my own personal opinions on each of the episodes. And we sort of, it's a hell of a journey, actually. When I sit down with the book myself and flip through, it's 763 pages,
Wow.
and it's, I think it's pretty darn good myself. I flip
It's
through it because.
great.
Because the way I wrote it, and actually one of the reviews explains the way I wrote it, because it was one of the reviews where Beverly Hillbillies was like 9 episodes into a storyline that should have been over already, and I had nothing to say. So the review is about, I take everyone aside and I show them, tell them how I write the book, just in lieu of having anything interesting to say about the episode. And I was just literally, I would sit down, I'd watch 3 episodes a day, immediately write a page about each one, and I did that for 666 episodes, and then combined them all, put them together, and that's this big book, which actually I had to adjust the margins because there's a weird thing with the formatting of the print book that a couple of the pages look slightly strange. I don't mind them, but you might think they look slightly strange. That's because if they weren't looking slightly strange, the book would have been over 800 pages, and Amazon doesn't allow books over 800 pages. So I was literally at the point where it was like, if you go any further, you can't, it has to be 2 volumes. And I said, I don't want it to, I wanted a volume you could pick up, read, and then hit someone with. And that's the book.
It's perfect for muggings. Like if you want to protect
Yes.
yourself from a mugging, I find that it's really good.
Put it in a bag and poof, get some.
It doesn't leave bruises.
No,
So you can kill your spouse. So
no.
and that's a reference to a Las Vegas crime I don't expect anybody to get. Anyway, what you made me think of briefly, and we'll jump into to I almost said James Bronson, to Charles Bronson after this is James, you are Charles today. You are Charles Bronson. So is you're talking about gatekeeping, and I think we talked about this on another episode, but there was this years ago, and I'm still obsessed with it. They released Batman, all the episodes of Batman on DVD, and there was a board, and I don't even know how it came on this board because I love Batman, but I'm not like a fervent Batman fan, and it's not like I'd be on a Batman forum, but there was a Batman forum, and some guy was claiming that it was not complete uncut episodes.
I remember that.
Yes, do you remember this? Because when he was a kid, he saw an episode where Batman comes out of a manhole or something to that effect.
That's right. That's right. No, it was the first episode is cut because I remember, and this was like 2014, because I remember when I saw this show on syndication back in the early 70s, there was a scene where the Riddler climbs out from a manhole. And so this is wrong. And
Yeah.
people, and yeah.
And nobody, and everybody was like, there's no scene like that ever, and you probably just remember it wrong. And he was insistent, and it was literally dozens of pages of people trying to tell this guy
Yes.
it's just a childhood memory, and this is not an a cut episode. There's nothing's been taken out of it or not added back in or whatever. And
Yes.
he was certain of it,
It
and
was,
it
it's
went on for
hilarious.
pages. And maybe I somebody posted about it and I just had to check it out. But I was obsessed with this guy because I had somebody, and I hope he doesn't listen to this because I'm not trying to pick on anybody, but somebody contacted me on my Made for TV Mayhem page on Facebook, and they were like, you should be doing episodes of the uncut versions of these TV movies. And I'm like, what do you mean uncut? And he's like, well, Bad Ronald's missing 16 minutes. And I'm like, no, all TV movies were 74 minutes in the 70s. They weren't 90 minutes. And but he was really like, oh my God, these are cut. Everything from 1964 to 1979 is cut. And I'm furious about it. And I was like, no, that they actually only ran 74 minutes in a 90-minute programming slot, right? And he was just really upset. So it happens.
That Batman guy, I remember one of his things was whenever they asked him to prove it, he would say, "Well, why do I have to prove it? Show me I'm wrong." And they're like, "Wait, so you're saying that 40 years ago you saw a 3 second shot of the Riddler, and now you insist that the whole set is because of that?"
Yeah.
And there's a, "Well, why am I wrong? Why are you ganging up on me?" And it was like, "Because you're the only one saying it over and over again."
Yeah, I was like, and I think we've talked about this before. It keeps coming up, but that's a good example of like what you can find on the internet. Sometimes people, they're passionate, and that's fine, but then there's like an extra level there where you're just like, oh, I gotta pull back. I can't.
I didn't expect Henning versus Gatekeepers. I really didn't. And the first one that came at me was like, "What?" And it's clear, it was clear that he loved the shows but hadn't seen them in years. And so he kept he was he I'll just say real quick, he brought up a specific episode from Petticoat Junction where they show at a local, the Hooterville Theater, they show the movie Wings. From 1927, and they have the stars of Wings on the episode. And it came, it was in between the episodes where Granny goes to Hooterville for the first time, which is huge, and the episode where Dr. Craig, Kate Bradley's replacement, shows up, which is huge. And
Yes.
he said to me, "So I was looking at the sample on Amazon, and you only got one page on the very iconic two-part story about Wings, where the characters show up." And he was angry. And I said, "Well, first off, it was one part, not two. And second, while it is a great episode, did you see the episodes on either side of it?" And it took, it was one of those things where, like, well, yes, of course, Granny showing up in Hooterville for the first time is important. But the Wings episode, I thought, who am I having a conversation with? Eventually, I just end up saying, "Are you going? Have you bought the book? Is the book on the way? I'm not going to buy the book because of something like that." Okay, then the conversation's over.
Yeah, I
Go
know.
back, put on BTV, do whatever, leave me
I've
alone.
gotten two bad reviews for my book because I don't have every TV movie in it. And it's like, you know what? That's a five volume set. It's literally 5,000 movies and plus. And and so whenever I see that, it's just like, okay, I don't know what to say. But I get like 2-star reviews because of it. And it's just like, okay, it is what it is. And if Charles Bronson was here, he would be smacking the shit out of all these people.
He'd slap their heads into the wall.
He would. He would. And I miss that he's not here to do that for us. And so I don't have a lot of notes. Surprisingly enough, there was very little information about Charles Bronson on any of these projects. So I don't have a lot of trivia, but I did write up a little mini biography, and I would recommend that anybody who is interested in Charles Bronson's life, at least up to 1974, should go on Roger Ebert's website. He did this really amazing interview with Charles Bronson in 74, a little bit before they shot Death Wish. And then the second portion of the interview is on the set of Death Wish. And it's a pretty candid interview in that Roger Ebert had a very difficult time getting Charles Bronson to say much of anything. And then he kind of opened up at the end. And it's a really interesting look at his life. He was very, I don't know how to describe Charles Bronson. And maybe before we get started with the biography, and I meant to tell you guys I might ask this question, is let's all go around real quick and talk about just real briefly what your favorite Charles Bronson movie would be. Because I know my favorite movie is Death Wish 4. It will always be Death Wish 4. And I know of all the Death Wishes and all the stuff that Charles Bronson starred in, why. But I've been thinking a lot about this. So Charles Bronson is new to me. I fell in love with him in the early 2000s because my grandfather got very ill and he was bedridden, and he liked action movies. And my cousins and I would send him films. But the thing is that my cousins were sending him all just whatever. And it turned out he didn't like Westerns, and they were constantly sending him Westerns, right? And I was sending him action movies, but I would watch them before I sent them. And so I had remembered he and I watching Death Wish 4 at some point before he got sick, like the last third of it. And so that was the first one I picked up, and I sat down to watch it, and I loved it. I loved it. And it was really my reintroduction to that era of action films and all that stuff. It's great. A, Charles Bronson at that stage looked a little bit like my dad, so that was really nice. Also, I love it because it's a really fun entry into what is a pretty dark series. And I love that he's like the bumbling vigilante. You know, he's always getting caught doing stuff. And there's this great scene where he's broken into somebody's apartment in a high rise, and the guy comes back to his apartment and he goes, "What are you doing here?" And Charles Bronson goes, "Making a sandwich." And then he throws the guy out the window, right? And it's brilliant. And so he has to kill everybody that, "Hey, what are you doing here?" And he blows them up or something. And it's amazing. And so I've always had like a really soft spot for that film. And watching it with my grandpa, because after my father died, my grandfather was still alive and things were really difficult. And so I went to go visit him, and we would watch these movies together. And so I started to get really into them. And that's when I came to really develop an affinity for Charles Bronson. And he's been close to my heart ever since. James, what is your favorite Charles Bronson movie?
Well, I think the best Charles Bronson film is clearly Once Upon a Time in the West.
Sure. Yeah.
But at the same time, does that mean it's the best Charles Bronson film in inverted commas, right? Because I don't necessarily think of it as a Charles Bronson film. I think of it as a Sergio Leone film. So I think that's his kind of like shining achievement in cinema. And that film goes without saying. It's obviously a masterpiece. But my favorite Charles Bronson film, as we would typically understand a Charles Bronson film, is probably 10 to Midnight.
Awesome.
And I'd be watching these films when I was quite young, 12, 13, 14, 15, when they would be on the telly, or you'd get them from the video shop, you know, through the Canon films that he was making in the 1980s. And there was always, I don't know, you know, me and a couple of my friends would be the only ones who'd really like them. And I don't know whether I got a little bit snobby in my early kind of late teens, early 20s. And I just assumed that these films would have been trash that I liked when I was young, but I just keep returning to them. And I just think they're almost endlessly rewatchable. And now I'm quite happy to just admit that these are some of my favourite films, really. And I judge a favourite film by how many times I want to watch it and how many times I do return and watch it. I love 10 to Midnight, I think, especially the uncut version. I think they did two versions of it, a slightly less explicit version and a fully explicit version. And the explicit version is just astonishing. I mean, they really push it in terms of the content for the sex and the violence. And he's such a kind of great presence. And around those, when I was just getting into cinema in the late 80s, those were the films that were being released in the video shop. They were the big releases. Assassination, You know, the Death Wish 4, that type of thing. And you know, I love those Canon ones, really, the ones he made in the 80s for Canon. And those are the ones that really stick for me and what I think of as Charles Bronson movies. But the best one is Once Upon a Time in the West.
Yeah, I love 10 to Midnight. I just did a episode of The History Continues where we discussed 10 to Midnight. I re-listened to it in case I had any tidbits I might want to use here, but I don't even think I make sense. So I'm really surprised anybody listened to it. But I had to rewatch it and I hadn't seen it in a while. And one of the things that struck me about that film that I talked about on the podcast was that it is kind of a trashy exploitation film in a lot of ways, I guess. I hate to use the word trashy, but it also sort of in a way captures women's lived experiences in that after he gets arrested and everything happens and he's re-released into the public for a while, you know, he goes back to his old job where he's murdered one of the coworkers at the beginning of the film. And the women are terrified of him, you know, and he comes into work every day. And I was just thinking about how in a metaphorical way, it kind of captures this idea of the kind of ways women have to always be on guard. And I think in a weird way, it actually captures a lot of stuff that women deal with, although that's not the main point of the film. And interestingly enough, when I was watching Donato and Daughter, which we're going to talk about later, it reminded me of 10 to Midnight because of that father-daughter relationship. And I thought that that was kind of an interesting similarity. They're not at all alike, really, but for that it did. But I really like 10 to Midnight. It's a really interesting film. I think that the guy, is his name Gene Davis, who plays the killer? Very brave actor.
He's fantastic.
He's so good in it. He's so good in it. And Lisa Eilbacher, of course, who was in This House Possessed, my favorite TV movies in it. And it's just, it's a really wonderful film. It's just really good. And I love when they turn the tables on him. And anyway, there's a lot to love about 10 to Midnight. Easily in my top five, probably, Charles Bronson movies that I've seen so far. Dan, what's your favorite Charles Bronson movie?
My favorite, I'm going to leave out The Great Escape. And I'm going to say it's either one of two, because Death Wish 3 is a movie I like very, very much.
So good. Yeah, it's great.
And it's just...
it's a cartoon.
It's that Michael Winner period was doing Scream for Help and the Lady in Red or whatever that other one was he made around there where he was just nuts. But the Charles Bronson film that I go back to the most is Breakheart Pass, which I think is based on an Alistair MacLean novel. And I think it's just the most sort of... I love the setting. I love the story. It's one of those movies where the you see that if you ever seen the poster, and I won't tell you what the poster is if you haven't seen it, but if you see the main poster for Breakheart Pass, you see it and you think, oh, that doesn't happen in the movie. And then you watch the movie and it happens and you're like, whoa. And I'm not going to say what it is, but it's an crazy action scene involving a train. And there's a moment in it that is immortalized in the artist rendering on the poster, and you're like, whoa. And it's just so good. It's so nicely, I think because it was based on a novel, it's so nicely put together and structured, and there's so many great actors in it, and the being on the train in the snow, it's just like he's great in it, starting off looking kind of like a skeezy, slightly, who is this creep kind of guy. And then as the movie goes along and it becomes more like, I'm the hero, it's really cool. And I think that's the one I love Death Wish 3, but Breakheart Pass is the one I can throw on at any time. And it's only 90 minutes long, which is wonderful. You throw it on, have a good time, go about your business. So that's my favorite.
Yeah, that's the one I haven't seen. So I still have a lot of Bronson to discover, which is another good thing. I'm really stuck in the Canon kind
of
era.
Oh, sure, of course.
And there's a lot I know that are blind spots. So I'm really glad we did this episode because, first of all, I didn't realize how much television he had done prior to like going to Europe and making a name for himself there. But he's wonderful in everything that I've seen. And so I'm really looking forward to not revisiting, but discovering a lot of his work.
I just had a thought about Charles Bronson, why I was intrigued with him so much when I was a kid in the 80s. Because when I was young and I couldn't watch R-rated movies, all the other, in the first half of the 80s, all like the other action guys, like Stallone and Eastwood, they did PG and R-rated movies. But Bronson was the only one, I think, who did R-rated movies and who specifically, like with like The Evil That Men Do and Kinjite and 10 to Midnight.
Kinjite.
You know, my relatives would be like, oh, those are rough, Dan. You don't want to watch those. You know, stick with Sylvester Stallone and Victory. and Pele playing soccer or something. Don't go. But that was the thing when I was a kid, like Charles Bronson was the almost the taboo one because all his films were rated R. And so if I wanted to see them, I had to either get special dispensation from my mother or make sure she wasn't in the house. So yeah, that was one of the things with Bronson. Yeah.
And they're kind of reprehensible films, right? Are they known as reprehensible films? Yes. There's something really like that you have to. Yes. It's nice being with people who have no problem defending them. And I've got no problem defending them, but yes, like exactly. They are known as like Death Wish 2, for example. They're infamous movies, right? Infamous. Yeah. They are adult material. There's no question about it.
Yes. Yeah, I remember very specifically my stepdad, may you rest in peace. He passed a few months ago. He used to show me anything that he had, but The Evil That Men Do was one where he was like, I don't know about this one, Danny. and I thought if he's like, he showed me Fulci's Gates of Hell, you know, Dawn of the Dead. And I was like, well, if he's not showing me that, I'm going to pass for now. And I didn't see it till years later.
Yeah, he just, I don't know. Charles Bronson has an appeal too, because he really stood out to me from the other guys. He was just, there's something really unique about Bronson. But I think, you know, I could give a spiel, I guess, but I feel like it would be really superficial. I think when it comes down to it, it's that he reminds me so much of my father physically that after my dad died, it became like a really, like to watch a Bronson movie became like a really special thing for me. And then I just loved the films. And I don't know. I mean, you guys say, it's interesting you use the word reprehensible. And and I'll talk about it at the end, but you know, I just recently did a video essay for the Toolbox Murders. And that they just announced, so I could talk about it. And everybody I know, when I talk about that movie to them, they're like, it's so trashy. And I'm like, that's a movie about a guy who lost his daughter. Mm-hmm. And then nobody knows how to respond to that. You know, yes. They're like, Oh, no, it's about a guy who for 20 minutes kills lots of naked people. And it's like, well, but it's actually about why he did it. You know, it's so like, I like, it's so like, I feel like I watch movies, maybe, I don't know what's a right or wrong way to watch a movie, but I watch movies with this idea that there's humanity in all of them. So I kind of find it where I can, I guess.
I think with Charles Bronson, though, like in The Evil That Men Do, Kinjite, those sorts of films, he's up against these sort of things like Clint Eastwood in Tightrope, like up against that really sort of dark.
Yeah.
And his movies in the 80s, apart from some of the goofier ones, seem to be that. Whereas like I said, like Stallone would do a Rocky film. And oh, you sure, could show it to everyone. But then he'd do, I'm trying to think of an R-rated one. Was it Nighthawks or Paradise House? Sure. No, not Paradise. But you know what I mean.
Ooh, Rambo was rated R.
Rambo, of course. Yeah, the Rambos. The Rambos. That's a sitcom I want to see. but with Bronson, it was almost always like, that's like his films are, they're going to be fun to watch, but they're more adult. They're darker. They are
because Kinjite has, I mean, I haven't seen that in years, but it's got some crazy stuff in there. And all I remember is he made somebody eat their watch. And that's like one of my, I still, whenever I'm watching something and it looks like it's going to get aggressive, I'm like, he's going to make that guy eat his watch. So like, he's great. But like, he definitely has definite chapters in his career. Right. Mm-hmm. And so let's just talk a little bit about him. So he was born on November 3rd, 1921, in what was called the Scoop Town section of Ehrenfeld, Pennsylvania, which is a coal mining town. I have been to Ehrenfeld. I made a pilgrimage there when I lived in Pittsburgh. It's 90 minutes outside of Pittsburgh. And it's now kind of like a retirement community, and it's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. It's impossible to get to the coal mines. I tried, but it gets really hinky and difficult to get into that section. But I did walk around. It's a really small town. I walked around it. I did take some photos with a very old camera. I don't know where those photos are. And I had a sandwich. So it was great. And I have to say, it was really beautiful. And I ran into a woman who told me her uncle knew Charles Bronson. And that he would sometimes go to LA and stay with the Bronsons up until the end of his uncle's life. And so that was really cool. She called him Charlie, by the way. And his real name was Charles Buchinski. He was the 11th of 15 children born to Lithuanian immigrants. And he began working in the coal mines around the age of 16, which is where I think he got that amazing physique that we saw there in the 50s, well into his 70s, by the way. He always looked really good. As an adult, he found himself working a lot of odd jobs, but it turned out he was really good at painting. And when we get to Donato and Daughter, I don't know if you guys remember the paintings that he did in as his character, but I think those might have been his paintings, but I have no proof of that. I don't know if you guys know anything about his art, but so he was in Atlantic City and he met some members of a Pennsylvania acting troupe and they asked him to do some scenery work for them and then they let him act in exchange for it. And it turned out he really enjoyed it. And so in 1949 he relocated to LA and began to work on his acting skills at the Pasadena Playhouse.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he did a little work in theater in New York as well. But in 1974, right before he made Death Wish, he had this to say about acting on stage. He said, quote, "I have no interest in the stage anymore. From an audience point of view, it's old-fashioned. The position I've been in for the last 8 years, I have to think that way. I can't think of theater acting for one segment of the population in just one city. It's an ineffectual way of reaching people." End quote. I really like that quote. In the 1950s, he changed his name to Bronson because it was during the McCarthy era, and he was worried that his name was too Russian. And that's why he changed it to Bronson, apparently at the behest of his manager. A really interesting tidbit I found out was that he used to be roommates with Jack Klugman when they lived in New York. They both worked for the
Oh, the
postal
odd
service.
couple.
Could That's what he said. And he said that he was a total slob. And he was just like Oscar Madison. He said he was very well cast in that. But they used to work in the postal service together, and they worked in the Puerto Rican section of New York, which I thought was really neat. Anyway, he started getting work, but he had a really tough time kind of making a name for himself in the United States. He would end up making it big in France in the late '60s with a movie with a French title I'm not going to try to pronounce, but it translates into Farewell, Friend. It was a heist flick from France. And then, of course, a year later, he was in Once Upon a Time in the West, and he became this huge European star. Somewhere in 1971, he was voted as the most popular actor in the world. The credit I saw that given to was the Golden Globe, but I don't remember a Golden Globe award called Most Popular Actor in the World, so I don't know. Of his international fame, Bronson told Roger Ebert in 1974, quote, "One of the ironies is that I made my breakthrough in movies shot in Europe that the Japanese thought were American movies that the Americans thought were foreign," end quote. So he turned in a number of good roles in the United States, right? The Great Escape, Dirty Dozen, etc. But fame came to Bronson in his early 50s when he appeared in Michael Winner's controversial box office hit, Death Wish, which is an amazing film. Critics, of course, hated the violence of that film, but Bronson, in his very eloquent and say less but mean more way of saying things, he said, "We don't make movies for critics since they don't pay to see them anyhow." Winner said, Michael Winner, the director of Death Wish, he would go on to become a frequent collaborator with Bronson. They did The Mechanic, which is a movie we haven't mentioned that's amazing with Jan Michael Vincent. He did The Stonekiller and a few others. And a little piece of trivia, Michael Winner used to date Jill Ireland, who would become Bronson's second wife, but
Oh.
they dated before he knew Bronson. And he, if you read Michael Winner's biography, which is just as cuckoo as his films, he talks about dating Jill Ireland, and it's really interesting because one of the things he says is when they broke up, one of the last things he did was grope her breast. And I'm only bringing that up now because after he became friendly with her and Bronson as a married couple, she was diagnosed with cancer. And he wrote this really eloquent, touching thing about her dying and Bronson dealing with it and Winner dealing with it. And it reminded me of how he made his films because it goes from like this crazy, like, oh, then I touched her breast, right? And then blah, blah, blah. And then he goes into this kind of poignant section about her death. And it really captures, I think, Winner the person. If anybody has a chance to read his biography, it's really interesting. But he said this about Bronson and his appeal. Winner said, quote, "The key to Bronson is the repressed fury, the constant feeling that if you don't watch the screen every minute, you'll miss the eruption. But coupled with the intense masculine dynamism, there's also a great tenderness in Bronson. Women respond sexually to that combination of danger and tenderness in him." So, Winner's trying to say that he had like this cross appeal, which we never talk about, but I do think women like Bronson. I know I do. And in 1974, Bronson and his wife Jill Ireland actually wrote a screenplay that was supposed to be about, well, not about, but based on Bronson's experiences working in the coal mining industry. But it was actually a love story. It was titled $1.98, never got made. Sounds unfortunate. They were only at the beginning of writing it when he mentioned it in this interview with Roger Ebert. And then, of course, Jill Ireland died in 1990. And Bronson kind of dropped out of sight. So he did two movies, and I don't know if he shot them before she died or right after. But in 91, two TV movies came out. And I know one of them was Yes, Virginia, There Is a Santa Claus. I can't remember what the other film is. I think it was a TV movie. And then he kind of disappeared until 1993, where he started working a little bit heavier in television. He would do The Seawolf for TNT, which is a movie he starred in with Christopher Reeve, based on a Jack London novel, and it's pretty good. I have it on VHS. Christopher Reeve is excellent in it. He did not really work well with Charles Bronson. He didn't say that they didn't get along, but he had a really difficult time because I guess Bronson is like, you know what, I'm gonna memorize my lines and I'm gonna come in and do the film. And Christopher Reeve is like, I'm gonna get into character. You know, he does all this stuff. He's got a different approach to it. And but the care they play nemesises, right, or rivals or whatever in the movie, and I think it kind of worked really well because I think that they were both sort of put off by each other's sort of approach to the roles. Anyway, of his tough image, he would sometimes feed the press about getting into fights and arrests, but there was never an arrest record of any sort that anybody could find. He also told people he fought in World War II, but he was actually stationed in Arizona, which he mentioned in an interview for Donato and Daughter. And then Bronson's acting career, as we said, was bookmarked by his work in television. He did a number of episodics. One of the things I didn't cover on this, I chose One Step Beyond, but he was also in Alfred Hitchcock Presents. And he also did a really great Twilight Zone episode called Two with Elizabeth Montgomery.
Yes,
Yeah,
yes.
really good. But everybody talks about the Twilight Zone. Let's talk about One Step Beyond, right? So that's why I chose that. But he did all kinds of stuff. I think he was in The Virginian. He often played Indians and things, Mexicans, because he was ethnic. And of course, he did the short-lived series Man with a Camera. Another TV movie, and this week when I was diving into my Bronson research, I put on Radon and Untebi, I think is how you pronounce it. And it started, and I was like, why didn't I pick this film? It's so good. But Bronson didn't show up till halfway into the movie, and I don't think that it really captures what I want to do here. But it's a very good movie, and we're going to cover it on the show. It's the same storyline that Delta Force is based off of, and I had no idea till I watched it. And then I also thought about picking Act of Vengeance, but I think that was made for HBO, so I wanted to stick with network television. And that's all I have about his biography, so I think we can dive in.
With a Camera, starring Charles Bronson.
I'm Mike Kovac, freelance photographer. Prize fighters and sports layouts are not my specialty. But this Joey Savoyan interested me. I had known him well as a nice kid on the East Side, but growing up seemed to have turned him sour. Suddenly, he was belting newspaper men around, smashing up cameras. Joey Savoyan had turned into a regular tiger, so they said, but I meant to have a picture or two of him with his claws out, if necessary.
Charles Bronson plays Mike Kovac, who is he was a World War II combat photographer, and now he is in the States trying to make his living as a photographer. And this episode is about him trying to get photographs of a young boxer, whose name I don't remember. I'm going to call him the young boxer. And he is, who doesn't want pictures taken of himself, and this boxer is about to fight the champ in a couple of weeks, and he's training at a camp in the middle of nowhere. He won't let the photographers in. Mike gets in briefly just because he knows the boxer. They grew up together, but it doesn't go well for Mike. The young boxer's girlfriend is also someone Mike knew from the old neighborhood growing up. I feel like it's Brooklyn, but I'm not 100% sure. And she says to Mike that the boxer is worried about something. Would Mike go to the training camp? He's staying, the boxer's staying in a little cabin on this camp in the middle of the night to talk to him. And Mike goes there to talk to him, and he discovers from the boxer that the last two fights or the last several fights he did were all fixed. He didn't know about it, but now his manager, the champ's manager, the gangsters who are in charge of everything, want him to throw the fight with the champ. And Mike says, that ain't happening. I'm going to get some pictures. We're going to save the day. And they set up a little trap to catch the bad guys in the act of doing bad guy stuff. So they call the gangsters and the champ and everyone over to the cabin, and they have Mike hidden away. And I'm going to leave it there because does their plan work? Doesn't it work? Do they get in trouble? Does something sinister happen? I'm just going to leave it right there. Boxers.
Boxers. Yeah, he kind of got stereotyped as a boxer. Now, I didn't read anything in his biography that he was a boxer, but I was pretty sure I'd heard somewhere that he used to box, not
I
professionally
bet he.
maybe,
I don't bet he did.
but semi-professionally. Yeah, I mean,
He
his
looks
physique
good.
was ridiculous. But I love that you ended it where you ended it, because I'm going to have a lot to say about that scene, the
Okay.
gotcha scene, because it's amazing. But yeah, so this is the only TV series that was ever given to Charles Bronson. I feel like I'm going to, there's not a lot of background on it. I feel like I'm going to give all my background talking about it, but the press was kind of cruel to Charles Bronson, and I don't understand why exactly, but they kept saying how ugly he was, like in newspaper articles, and they actually had a headline promoting an interview with him that said, "Homely Hero will debut in Man with the Camera." And you know, it was very upsetting. I had never seen this before, and I really enjoyed it. It's only a 30-minute episode, and so it goes by at a clip. I think what I like about it most is that I'm so used to Charles Bronson as kind of the older action hero in the canon films, that to see him in something like this was really fun for me. It's a different kind of performance. It's really enjoyable. I think my favorite of these three is going to be The One Step Beyond, but I don't want to go too into that. But this is like a really fun, spirited performance. It's a clippy show. It moves really fast. It's kind of goofy. At the time, ABC was a fledgling network. That's where it premiered. I should say this show aired in 1958, 1959. And so we're going way back into his career. And ABC was the third in the network's ratings, and they didn't have as much money to put towards a lot of their programming. So their shows were actually known for being more low budget, and because they had to fill the same amount of programming blocks, but they weren't getting the same amount of money from advertisers. So their shows were noticeably cheaper, apparently. To me, that's charming. I like the way they did it. It's a very it's not stagey at all, but it's definitely like there's three sets. Let's make the most of it. And before I go on and we talk more about the show, I was really charmed by it. I thought it was pretty good, and I'd like to see more episodes. James, what did you think of it?
I enjoyed it, and I think I'm going back to the idea of him being a boxer. I'm a huge boxing fan, you see. So whenever I watch boxing scenes in films, I always like to see whether the actor can move and whether he looks realistic. And I have to say, I don't think I've ever seen an actor look as comfortable in the ring as Bronson here, especially given that, again, it's a television episode. He hasn't had 6 months of training like they would have if it was a big Hollywood movie, that type of thing. Right? He's clearly just been given the gloves and kind of get in. And his footwork and the way he moves with the around with Tom Laughlin, who's the guy playing the opposite boxer, and the way he moves, his puts his jab out. It's with pure ease, right? He's clearly comfortable in the ring sparring, so he's clearly done it. And I was really, really impressed with that stuff. And I love shows about boxing and films about boxing. And so I have to say, I really enjoyed it. I mean, it's an odd program to watch as someone from England, right? Because we didn't, I'm sure they might have been on television over here. We didn't really get anything like that. The formula is feels odd. It feels very American to us, right? To me. And clearly it is. I mean, that sounds like a really stupid thing to say, right? An
Oh, no, no. No.
obvious thing to say. But it's like nothing looks like that anymore, right? That television doesn't look
Yes.
like that, and ne
Sure.
never really did to me growing up. But I did enjoy it very, very much, and the performances I thought were good. And obviously, Bronson's really good. Tom Laughlin's really good. I didn't get the name of the person who played the girlfriend, but I thought she was quite good. And I also like right down to there's a really funny scene after Charles Bronson's been knocked out by the young boxer, where the waiter comes in and is kind of like taking the mickey out, mocking Charles Bronson a bit. That's a really, really funny scene.
Tell me, barbecue sauce has some very good healing qualities. Or would you rather I get you an ice bag for your head?
So even down to the supporting cast is really quite impressive.
Yeah, so I want to tell you the woman who plays Dolly is Ruta Lee, and she's a pretty well-known character actress. And when I here in the States, and when I was watching it, I was thinking, God, she looks so familiar to me, but I'd never seen her that young before. So I had to look it up to realize. And then her IMDb picture is her slightly older. And it was like, oh, yeah, I've seen her in a gazillion things. And I think she mostly does comedy. But here she's not the femme fatale, but she's the boxer's love interest, and she's very much girl next doory in it. And she's great. I really like that actress, and it was nice to see her in such an early role.
You were saying?
I don't know what I was saying, except that he's in trouble and he needs your help. Look, Joey phoned me today right after he'd seen you this afternoon. And he said it just occurred to him how you could help him out of all this mess he's in. He wants you to come out to the camp tonight after dark. That is, if you're willing. And he'll see to it that the rear door of his cabin is unlocked.
What's all the cloak and dagger business?
Mike, believe me, I don't know the details. All I know is that he begged me to have you come out tonight to bring your camera and just listen to what he has to say.
I was shocked really how, for a pilot, it just kind of goes straight into the story. You don't really get much. You get a little bit of background on Kovac, and then before you know it, he's knocking some bloke down to get into a tent to take some photographs. Mm-hmm. He's quite chatty in it, Bronson,
yes.
Right? More so than you would expect him to be. His character's, you know, he's got a lot of kind of like a lot of talk, and but at the same time, really no nonsense. The only other thing I noticed, you'd know more about this, is that I think, is it filmed? It's supposed to be set in New York, right? But it must be filmed in Hollywood, I would think.
Yeah.
Because like they're in the countryside, which looks like the Hollywood countryside, outside of Hollywood to me.
That's a really good question. I do believe it was shot in Los Angeles, but they did do a lot of productions in New York back then too. But I'm pretty sure it's LA, but I'm actually not positive.
No, I think I really liked it. There was a really good moment of kind of TV writing and directing, where he says to Tom Loughlin's character, the boxer, he says, what are you going to do? Well, answer me. He doesn't even give the guy a chance to answer before they've only got, 27 minutes or 24 yes. minutes or whatever. So there's no time to hang around waiting for an answer. He demands an answer straight away.
That's how we do it here in the States. We don't listen to anybody anyway, so it's okay. Dan, what did you think?
When you mentioned that ABC didn't have as much money as the other networks, the thing I thought about this, and I had to look it up, I thought this was a syndicated show from the way it looked. It reminded me of a show like Soldiers of Fortune or Highway Patrolman or Whirlybirds. It seemed a little cheaper than, and in fact, it was. But it does the good thing where it starts off in the big space outside, lots of extras, the boxing ring and everything, and then gradually it gets into like smaller rooms.
Yeah.
So you've seen the expanse, and now when it's like, okay, we spent all the budget there, throw the sets together, put us in the smaller spaces kind of thing. I think it's a fun episode. As James mentioned, it's one of those shows. This was the way kind of quite a lot of the shows were back then, where the first episode, heck, I Love Lucy does this. Just it throws you right in. There's no explanation. Like when I said that he was a World War II combat photographer, I don't think that's mentioned in the episode that I can remember. Maybe he says it. I forget, but I read that somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And they kind of, and that's what the way they would do it is you would either get a show like, say, the second season, Man with the Camera On, it was on the same season as Bourbon Street Beat. And Bourbon Street Beat, the first two episodes are setup episodes for the show, which is not something you normally saw because they wanted to get them in syndication and they wanted to show them in any order they could. So seeing the first episode of Man with the Camera, where you're just thrown right in, you don't know what's going on, that's very sort of standard. And what you, in my mind, like it would be when I would sit down to watch the show, you would gradually glean what the character was and where they came from, et cetera, across the run of the show. And then if I went back and watched the second time I watched this episode, things would mean a lot more to me because I'd be so familiar with the character. Now, not to say that that's a bad thing or a good thing. That's just the way they did stuff back then. I think this is a pretty solid character. It's nice to see Mr. Bronson chatty. I don't want to say anything about the ending just yet, but this is that space in American television where, apart from like the Untouchables, most TV shows of this sort were a half an hour. But like I actually looked at the schedule, this show ran opposite Phil Silvers, Sergeant Bilko, and the M Squad, which
See,
was
now I don't have M Squad. I have what's called the Best of the Post.
Which was an
NBC special titled Valley of the Blue Mountain.
Oh, interesting. Okay, yeah, no, I have M Squad on mine, but hey, maybe both of them.
It's
Why not?
possible. It's hard to know because I used a newspaper to get the
Oh, yeah,
listings,
okay.
and it's possible that I was looking at the, but I think I got the show right. I think it said
Okay.
NBC, but I'm not positive. But they might have had M Squad and then had a special that night.
Well, possibly, yeah. I like the fact that it's going up against M Squad because M Squad, first off, is if you've ever seen Police Squad, then you've seen M Squad, but the silly version. But M Squad and Man with the Camera are the half hour type shows, which apart from Untouchables was generally the way it worked in the 50s. But following Man with the Camera was 77 Sunset Strip,
That's
which
right.
sort of set the template for detective shows into the mid to late 60s with all its spin-offs and all sorts of other shows, and began making all the shows an hour long. So we're at an interesting point here where for the past 4 or 5 years, most adventure shows are a half an hour, but Following Man with the Camera is the show that will change everything to an hour.
Oh, that's
And
fascinating.
I kind of like that because I love the half hour because they're snappy and they get in there, they do their business and go. But the hours give you a little more time to coagulate with everyone, as it
Sure,
were.
yeah.
So, but I think overall it's a fun episode, but it's also one of those episodes where if you show someone randomly, they might get to the end of it and think, so what? And then you have to show them another one and
Yeah.
sort of get, you might have to try to binge them on it just a little to get more out of it because it's a very basic episode. And I feel like if you watch four or five more, six more, you grow to understand the character and what it's doing a little more. But that's the way they did shows back then. And we dealt with it. Not that I was alive in 1958 or 1959, but in my heart I am.
Okay.
So that's me on that.
So one of the things I really like about Man with a Camera, on a totally personal note, is that he's sort of a detective by proxy, right? Like Murder, She Wrote. Like he's just this guy who is supposed to be taking pictures for a newspaper, and he ends up kind of becoming a detective in all these different mysteries, right? And that's the premise of the show. I really like the idea of people just sort of haphazardly falling into crimes. That's always such a, and like on Heart to Heart, there's, how many people do you know that got murdered? Like Heart to Heart and Matt Houston, all their murders were based off people they knew. Like
Yeah.
Matt Houston's like, that's my cousin, or that's a friend, or that's a friend of my cousin's, right? Every episode. And it's like, how many people do you know that get murdered, right? And wherever Jessica Fletcher goes, there's a murder, and you're like, maybe she's killing everybody. You're not quite sure, right? So, but yeah, I love when people just kind of haphazardly fall into these sort of mysteries. And that was one of the things about the show that really delighted me. And the other thing that I really liked was, as you both had said, he talks a lot in it, and he's kind of animated, and it's a little different than the strong silent type that I kind of came to know him as in the other, like the Golden Globus movies he was doing and stuff. And so it was like kind of a new view of Bronson for me. I mean, I think he's famous for not talking, right? Like he's Once Upon a Time in the West, that's a pretty much like dialogue-less, is that a word, role, right? Like it's
That
not,
is close enough.
yeah. And so I think that's how we interpret him and how he kind of personified himself, right? Like with Roger Ebert, he had a really hard time getting him to talk. And he was like that in a lot of interviews. And actually, I have a friend who met Charles Bronson twice, and the first time he met him, Bronson didn't want to have anything to do with him. He just couldn't. He's just like, I can't even talk to you right now. I don't even want to be in the same room with you. And then he met him sometime later, and they ended up having an entire conversation about like all these films that Bronson had made. And it's really interesting. Like, as a person, he, Dana Delaney said, and I have this quote in here, he's a tough nut to crack. And I kind of think that's how maybe we all see him. And so to see him in a different way was really great. But one of the other things that I love, you went through the story pretty well, but I want to go up to the climax here. So he's got this boxer friend that's doing something that's mysterious, and he has to figure out why things are the way they are and why he's become so brutish and tough and like hard to get to and reach and get a photo of and do all this stuff. And we find out that he's being blackmailed, and he's supposed to like take a dive at this next fight. And all the fights he's been doing, he's been basically, he didn't realize, but the other boxers had to take the dive, and that was kind of building him up. And then they were so that the betting odds would be in his favor. But then when he loses, the winner, you know, whoever voted or voted, whoever bet on that guy will end up making a shit ton of money, right? So, and of course, this guy's got ethics and he's really struggling with it. So Bronson's or Kovacs is like, okay, let's figure this out. I'll take a picture of you with no context talking to somebody that nobody knows, and we'll somehow get this whole thing settled. And so, they're like, okay. And so he turns on all the lights. The scene is so good. He turns on all the lights and he doesn't even get into a closet. He gets behind this like little partition where you get dressed, like behind it. And then he's somehow going to get the photo of the guy, but he hooks up this giant flash on top of his camera. And I'm like, that's going to clue him in that somebody else is in the room. And I remember even thinking, what if he had a Polaroid? He'd be like, I don't know if you've ever been near a Polaroid, but they're really loud. And so he's setting up with this giant flash behind this like thing that's not even rooted into the ground. And he's like, all right, I'm going to take a photo of you. So then the bad guy comes in looking very much like Captain Steubing in sunglasses. I actually thought it was Gavin McLeod because he used to play heavies on a lot of episodic television. Mm. And he's like, all right, boxer guy, we're going to, you know, practice the fight here and then you'll know what to do. And Kovacs is behind this partition, and when he takes the photo, he knocks it over, but literally in a split second, he's actually jumped through a closed window.
Yes. With his camera,
and he smashes it and he's off. And it's the most amazing thing I've ever seen because he's like lightning. Like I don't even remember seeing him leave the partition and go through the window. It's so beautifully shot. And then he's out into the woods and then he gets caught and then they have to go back and there's another confrontation. But that scene for me made the whole show so amazing. And one thing that Bronson said in interviews was he actually didn't like the pilot script at all. He didn't think that there was enough action in it. And he said that he wanted a show that had action. He said, I'm not going to walk up to a mark and just say some lines. I want some action in it. He actually said that. He said that the later scripts got much better. So I think that they must have incorporated a lot more of that element into it. And I haven't gotten past the pilot, so I don't know. I think for a first episode, it's a lot of fun. And considering all the kind of gumshoey type shows that were so popular back then, you know, I don't know how to rank them because I'm not as familiar with them as I should be. But I think in terms of just entertainment value, I think this one, like I said, it's just a clip. It just moves so fast. Yeah. And I love that it's just got all this energy in it. And so that's one of the things that I really loved about the show. And I was just curious what you guys thought about this kind of end of it. Like, did you think that, I mean, the story, I don't know exactly what kind of question I'm asking to lead you guys into a discussion, but but what do you think about the way it goes from point A to point B? Do you have any thoughts on that, either one of you?
You know, it's clearly of its time, right? So like you're looking at this, I mean, you know, I never really saw these type of shows. It feels quite stagey. And I suppose a lot of it depends on whether you like that type of thing. I mean, you're right, it is an odd final scene to have him kind of sneaking around behind this this dresser with this camera, with this guy who doesn't take his sunglasses off, trying to take this as a contextless photograph. But, you know, you're watching these actors who you know from other programs and other films, and I enjoyed it. I knew what type of thing it was. I quite liked the girlfriend coming and saving the day by
The Rock. Yeah,
sure. Distracting the bad guys and stuff. And then there's a brief little shootout, so a punch up between the two boxers. They do actually get to have a fight. It only lasts two punches between before the champ's knocked out. But yes. I thought it was fun. And the way that the bad guys, they just kind of stand there passively while they've got this one gun trained on them rather than fight or run or do anything to get, you know, they're going to go to prison for a long time, and they just kind of like take it. And then it obviously just finishes as soon as he kind of calls the police. But, you know, I enjoyed it. It was, out of the three films, the three programs we're going to look at today, it was my least favorite. Let's put it that way.
I might say that too, but that doesn't mean it's not good. It's just,
I agree.
I really think it's if you were to watch, like I said, if you watch a brace of these, and then go back to this one, you'd be like, oh yeah, when you're more familiar with the character, you're more familiar with the way. I was surprised that this was a pilot. I thought of a couple random shows like Monster Squad and Wizards and Warriors, which aren't helpful at all right here, but were shows where they would shoot a pilot that was kind of like a first episode, but then save it for later. And the first episode would be like the sixth or seventh.
Yeah.
And so that's what this felt like to me. And the fact that it is the pilot feels like, wow, they're really, I'm surprised. Like, this aired before 77 Sunset Strip, which was like the breakout show from this season of American TV. So I'm surprised that it didn't do better, because the next season it ended up at like 10:30 at night on a Monday, which seems like a horrible time. I don't care what decade you're in, but 1959, 10:30 on a Monday night, I think everyone was sleepy.
I would think so, yeah.
Yeah, you're not up for the Bronson action, the Bronson chest to come at you oiled, you know, at 10:30 at night.
That was the highlight of the pilot, right? They were like, we don't even need a story.
Exactly.
Just take off your shirt. Exactly. Box.
Because people are going to be thinking about that the rest of the episode, and then it'll be over. I do love the way it ends, where it's very much like a 30s or 40s universal horror film. There's no goofing around. Give me the police and it's over. There's no final. There's no final scene. There's no. It's just, yeah, we're done.
But to go back real quickly to him taking off his shirt and boxing, and no, I'm not going to get lewd about it, but he didn't look like a lot of men in the 50s looked in these shows.
That, they look like, weirder, yeah.
They, well, they weren't as in shape. Now yes. That's regular. We see that everywhere. And if you're not in shape, now you stand out. But in everybody had these kind of like Ward Cleaver, just regular guy
yes.
physiques. Like, there's nothing wrong with Ward Cleaver, right?
Yeah, that the Leave It to Beaver boxing episode is one of my favorites.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess it would be like comparing Ward Cleaver to Wally, right? Because Wally was very athletic, right?
Yes. Yeah,
and yeah. So like and so Wally was not the norm for TV in the 50s. The men just looked more like just your everyday guys, yeah. And Wally looked more like what the actors look like today, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was kind of interesting. So he stood out in a lot of ways. A, because you didn't see that many people who weren't white leading TV shows, mm-hmm. right? And also people built quite like that. You just didn't see that to my memory on TV, or men even really taking off their shirts.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't remember that being a big thing.
Like in Father Knows Best, there weren't a lot of bare chested episodes with him teaching the kids lessons.
I'm super happy. About
Robert
that
Young.
Too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I might be okay with that part, but, but like, so like there's some interesting things in the show that feel unique to me for the era. And also James, I didn't even think about the girlfriend saving the day, but she really does. And that
she does. Yeah.
I can't believe that didn't even stand out to me. I feel like such a non-feminist now, but like, that's kind of an important thing. That you did not see that in TV back then.
And it's so wonderfully done too, because it's like she looks in, sees trouble, throws a rock through, and they say like, what made you do that? She was like, well, I looked through the window and saw you guys in trouble, so I threw a rock. Why would I?
Why wouldn't I help you? Yeah, yes. And so it's kind of cool. Like this, now the more I'm thinking about it, I mean, this episode, so I love having these discussions, is doing a lot more than it looks like on the surface, right?
Yes.
So, and that's kind of really nice and really great to think of a Lithuanian heading a TV show, which I didn't even think about either. Mm-hmm. But so this is a really fun one. I don't know that there's much more to say about it though. Did you guys have anything else you wanted to add?
No, that was it for me. Really.
No, I think I'm good.
Okay. So I kind of gave all the background already in it. So Dan, already you said what it ran against. Oh, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. It didn't run against. I was mixing up my shows. It ran against something called Cavalcade of Sports. I didn't have M Squad. I had Cavalcade of Sports.
I'm going to look again.
Yeah. Well, it's from a newspaper ad. So I don't know if that night they didn't show it I didn't get the network correct. I can't remember, but it's either M Squad or Cavalcade of Sports.
Mm-hmm.
And I already kind of did all the trivia. A, people thought he was ugly, which is ridiculous. B, he wasn't as happy with the pilot as he was with the rest of the series. And also, to prepare for the role, Bronson actually went around and he contacted several of the country's top photographers, and he asked them about their equipment. Because apparently every episode they use some kind of what would be considered brand new technology back then.
Oh, nice.
And they incorporated it into the show. So he wanted to make sure that he really understood the camera technology of the day. So he actually talked to a lot of photographers to get that part of the research done, which I thought was really interesting. I didn't even think of that when I was watching it.
This is a small storeroom of the Lost Property Department of the London County Council. There are many such rooms, but they're rarely visited anymore, because the property stored dates back to the war. Property found on the streets or in the bombed out buildings, all waiting for claimants who never appear. Like this cheap copy of Venus de Milo, meant to stand in some garden. The ages have claimed her arms. The war claimed her head. Like, on what mantelpiece do you suppose this old clock was standing when the bomb hit? Calmly ticking, Time stop for it at 7:36 a.m. or p.m. What difference does it make? Baby strollers, cartons full of things, all tagged with the place and date of their destruction. The East End Arena, September 17th, 1944. Everything this room could tell 100 stories. But this boxing glove was involved in a most unusual occurrence. When, on September 17th, 1944, that dark and heavy curtain to the world beyond our five senses, the psychic world, was lifted for a moment.
Let's move on then to One Step Beyond, which I'm really excited to talk about.
He plays a boxer, Mr. Bronson, a boxer named Yank. Keep it down, keep quiet. And he plays a boxer named Yank who is boxing in September 1944 during the continuing London Blitz. And he is at, they're at the East End something or other, East End Arena, something like that. I'm sorry. And he is all set to box some guy, a British guy. And he's there with his manager. And we learn very quickly that Yank is maybe not in the best of health. He may have been in some sort of accident a few years ago and possibly shouldn't be boxing. But he is still going to box because he says that's the only thing he knows how to do. The manager for the opposing boxer shows up, and we learn the story of a gentleman named Paddy, P-A-D-D-Y, who was a boxer who used to box around here a lot. And he died one night. Another boxer was up in the ring, and he swore halfway through the fight, he swore that he saw Paddy sitting, his ghost sitting in the chairs, looking at him, kind of like shaking his head and going like, no, 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 no. And the boxer thought, well, he's telling me, his ghost is telling me not to box, but he continued to box and got killed. So Paddy is this kind of legend hanging over this boxing ring. If you see him, you're going to die. The opposing manager kind of puts this into Yank's head, and then Yank's manager tells him the rest of the story, but says it's all baloney. Uh-oh, though. Yank might believe it. And uh-oh, might Yank see Paddy a little later on? Or is it Paddy? Or is it something more sinister? Or what the heck is going on? No, Yank, no! So it's basically about, is there a ghost in the theater or not? And do you see, is he like a harbinger of death? And I'll just leave it at that.
So this aired in 1961. So this is just 3 years after Man with a Camera. And he was doing a lot of episodics at this point. Interestingly enough, two nights before this episode of One Step Beyond aired, Bronson played a boxer in an episode of the General Electric Theater titled Memory in White, and he was nominated for an Emmy.
Wow.
For that role. Now, I haven't seen this episode, and I don't think I could find it on YouTube, but I don't remember. I think I looked at it last minute because I didn't realize he did those so close together. So being a boxer, playing a boxer, he kind of got stereotyped, it looks like, because of that, I think his physique, for sure. And maybe he was really a boxer, like James noted. He looked like he knew what he was doing. I'm sure I saw this when I was a kid because I'm a really big One Step Beyond fan. When I was growing up, I think we got all the shows. I think we got Twilight Zone and Outer Limits and One Step Beyond, but this is the only one I remember from my childhood. And I don't want to say it's better than the Twilight Zone, but if I could champion it for a minute, it premiered 6 months approximately before the Twilight Zone. And if I'm correct, Rod Serling approached John Newland to let him know that he was going to be doing a similar show. And they were friends. And there's actually a piece of trivia I'll get into when we're done talking about this, where the two shows intersect in this episode. This show, the premise of the show, according to John Newland and Merwin Gerard, who was the creator of it, was that they were going to take quote-unquote actual ghost stories, so stories that already existed in the world, and then make episodes out of them. So the premise of their show was different than the Twilight Zone. It didn't really have any social commentary in it. And that show was heavily steeped in that. That was the whole point of that show. But Also, they were basing everything on this quote unquote fact, right? Like this supposedly really happened, and that was supposed to give it sort of this underlying sense of eeriness to the stories that they were bringing to the series. It's a very low budget show again. I think it shows, particularly in this episode, talk about stagey and very small sets. It's very economical the way it's put together. But for me, John Newland, and I feel like I could go on about John Newland forever and I won't, is such an incredible person. And I've always loved him since I was a kid. He was this dapper host of this great show. And then when the show was revived in the 70s, he came back and hosted it then. He may have directed some episodes. I think he might have even directed this episode of One Step Beyond. And then he would go on to create two different production companies that after he did some TV movies. Of course, he did Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, which I mentioned earlier, and Crawl Space. And then he formed a production company and he produced a lot of very domestic set dramas that are fantastic. A Sensitive, Passionate Man was David Janssen, who was nominated for an Emmy about an alcoholic. He did one called Overboard, about a couple that are breaking up that are on a ship together. And then he did my favorite, which is The Suicide's Wife, which is about a woman whose husband commits suicide, and the whole movie is about her trying to figure out why. And it's his most flawed film, but it's his most raw and most moving. And they all starred Angie Dickinson. And so he's this incredible filmmaker, and I kind of think he knew what he was doing. And one of the things I liked about this particular episode of One Step Beyond is the way it lays out the story.
You're a fool to be fighting, you know. It's a nasty scar. You're quite sure you're all right?
Why don't you mind your own business? Of course he's all right.
Well, I hope so. I really hope so.
Why don't you get out of here?
All right, your time's go and find my tiger. We don't worry about accidents here, do we, Whitey? Not with old Paddy Terhune about.
Who's Paddy Terhune?
Oh, he's dead.
In a manner of speaking.
The rival boxing manager comes in and kind of drops this hint about Paddy, but then Yank's manager is giving him that massage and he's telling him this whole story, and the way that he's just going around Bronson and kind of dropping like the story is really well done for me. I thought it built up the tension of the ghost story for me. And then we see Paddy and it's just this very quick kind of awkward cut because the camera shot itself is pretty good, but he's wearing the sweater that says Paddy on it, just in case you weren't sure who he was. And it's ridiculous, right?
It's like Ralph Malph.
Yeah, this is ridiculous. Or Laverne with the big L.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Yeah, it's just ridiculous. And it makes you laugh, and maybe it breaks a little of the tension. But overall, I felt like this episode had a great sense of dread. But what I liked most about it, personally, and it's okay if anybody disagrees, is that for me, of the three things that we watched for this episode, Bronson is really freaking good in this. He's so good. I've not really seen him in like a horror story, even though I know it's like light. He's so animated in it. And it's just a different performance than what I'm used to seeing. And I really liked it. And for me, that was the highlight of this. And we'll talk about that. What the fuck ending. It was amazing too. I thought this was really good, and I love all the One Step Beyonds. I will find something about all of them to love, but this is one that I really was taken with. I thought it was quite good. Dan, what did you think?
Well, my secret shame is that I'd never seen One Step Beyond. I know. Yeah. I was a Twilight Zone kid and Alfred Hitchcock and sure. Somewhat Outer Limits, and so I just never watched One Step Beyond, although I've heard wonderful things about it. I've just never experienced it. I'm a huge horror, eerie, weird anthology fan, but I think from sort of the 50s and before that, I'm more of a radio anthology mm-hmm. fan, like a Lights Out, Inner Sanctum, sure. Witch's Tale, Suspense, The Whistler, just because like in Lights Out, you can get really gross and you can go to weird places, but because it's audio, you're okay. Whereas I feel like I enjoy this One Step Beyond quite a bit, actually. And you're right. It's funny to see Bronson is sort of like right off the bat when you learn that he hasn't gone to see this doctor for a physical, and you're thinking, okay, he's not well. And he's more, I don't want to say vulnerable, because most of the time he's just in these little shorts and it looks like he could pick me up and throw me through a window. So that's not quite the word, but he's more there's something about the way his manager tells him the story about Paddy, And he just really gets into it. Like, yeah, and he said he died because he saw the ghost of Patty. And they say, if they ever see him and you're boxing, you're going to die too. And then he flips Charles Bronson over and Bronson is looking at him. And the manager's like, but it's all baloney. It's nonsense. Don't well, worry about it. It's like,
Dan,
but I think you
almost, you got to do that with an accent.
Oh no, not with James on here. No.
Yeah. We'll give James the script and we'll have him read it.
I wouldn't know. But I think it actually, when I got to the end of it, I thought I need to watch more One Step Beyond. Cause I think it's a solid anthology episode, and it's clearly taking place on a soundstage. When they walk, when they take the sign off, the all clear sign is revealed. That's clearly the entrance to a soundstage. And when Charles Bronson is walking down the hallway to his room, and he's like, oh God, I forget how he describes it, but he's like, yeah, that's just a corner of a soundstage, and they're acting like it's a boxing, you know,
right.
Boxers dressing. What is it? What do boxers sit in? Not dressing rooms. What am I thinking? Whatever sort of room it is,
locker
boxers
room.
Sit in.
Locker but
it's,
room.
Yeah, locker room.
Yes. And so they clearly it's on a soundstage, but I was surprised that there were so many people watching the match. I thought it was going to be one of those where, well, I guess they have to have Patty in the stands, but I thought it was going to be one of those where maybe you see a brief shot of the stands and then the rest of it is like all darkness.
And then you just hear this audience that you know is just
yes.
canned, right?
Yes. Yeah. That's what I thought it was going to be. But overall, I love a horror anthology. I love a weird anthology. And I thought this was a fun episode. It's not like, if you're looking for like Freddy's Nightmares or something like that, this ain't it. But this is sort of a charming, it's eerie. It's a very eerie episode. And if you watch it a second time, there are a lot of wonderful just like dropped in little moments that you may not have caught the first time that lead you to the ending. And then the ending has a great moment in it, which I won't say. And then it happens. And you're like, oh, nice. And watching John Newland walk amongst the all those picking up all those items and stuff like that. It's almost like, unlike say Rod Serling, who always looked a little, always was smoking and always was nervous because he was, John Newland has more of a feeling like, look at all this crazy stuff. Every one of these has a ghost story behind it. You feel like, ooh, John, are you nuts? No, he wasn't. No.
He's a bestow my heart. I love him.
He's great. I'm glad I watched it. Yeah.
And I want to mention briefly, because it's on my mind. So I mentioned earlier that Charles Bronson and Elizabeth Montgomery did a Twilight Zone episode title 2. It's pretty well known. But Elizabeth Montgomery's in one of the most famous episodes of One Step Beyond as well. And I can't remember the name of it, but you can go on her IMDb page and look it up. But it's really good. It's another ghost story. And she's great in it. And so, just in case anybody's interested in checking out more One Step Beyond, it's one of the most famous ones. But anyway, James, what did you think of this?
Yeah, I agree with this. The pair of you, I thought this was fun. I liked it. I didn't know One Step Beyond. And I'm glad you introduced me to it. And I did respond well to this one. I thought it was fun. You know where it's going right from the start. There's a kind of comfort in that. But it has got some affecting scenes, right? So even though it's old-fashioned, even though it's very stagey in some parts, it's still effective, it still gets to you. And so I'll just kind of read off my notes, really, because I like the England aspect, the fact that it's set in London. I'm not from London, but the fact that it's set in England and Britain was a fun thing. I especially liked it when Charles Bronson turned down the fish and chips in the first scene. Like, didn't want anything to do with that. There's a mention of the city of Birmingham as well, which must be quite rare. To mention Birmingham, even in British television programs, is quite rare. So in American television shows, must be extremely rare. That's a city where I'm close to where I was brought up. Birmingham, by the way, is the setting for Peaky Blinders. Do you have that over there?
I've heard of it, but I've
heard of
know.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's kind of a big BBC show, and I think some people watch it over there. But that it's got like Cillian Murphy in it, and Tom Hardy's been in it, and loads of big stars. I thought it was really good. I thought I like the boxing stuff. Yeah, it's set in the old East End Arena, which could be, I don't know whether that was a real place, but there's a very famous boxing venue in the East End called the York Hall in Bethnal Green. So it could be a reference to that. So it seemed to have some kind of knowledge of boxing history. The boxing scene, you're right, the talking scenes are very stagey, extremely stagey. But the boxing scenes are actually very, very, very well done. They're really realistic. There's got some lots of kind of scuffing shots. They're not really over the top. They're clearly hitting each other, even if not terribly hard. Both guys can clearly box and can move together. There's a couple of really great camera angles. One, a really low camera angle that must be placed right by their feet, looking up into the two boxers slugging it out. And then it's got a kind of reverse of that, which is an overhead shot above the ring. I don't know if you remember that shot, but really good, really sophisticated, really fantastic shot selection. And you're right about the crowd, and there's a really wonderful shot of two old ladies.
Yes, I remember
smoking
that.
And reading.
They were so great.
Yeah. Very, very, very funny. I really like that stuff. And all excellent. Bronson's excellent again. He's clearly the guest star in this, isn't he? Because there's whole scenes where he's not saying anything. He's clearly an act of a hire here rather than the main star.
Oh yeah.
I mean, there's long scenes where the managers are talking to each other.
Yeah,
but
there's
his performance is great. Yeah.
There's no star, I guess, of a One Step Beyond. I mean, I guess there are, but per episode. But because it was like an anthology show, I guess they're like ensembles sometimes too. Maybe. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely, Nick. That comes across. I mean, he's playing. At times, it felt like he was a supporting role rather than the main star of the episode. But it's a good, very physical performance. There's a great moment where he wrestles his opposition manager's hand away from his arm.
Oh, yes.
And really shows a kind of really strong physicality. And so that what you were mentioning about the explosion waiting to happen. He's not, he's contained, and then all of a sudden he shows this very short flash of anger and physical dominance. And it's a really strong performance by Bronson, actually. I thought it was great. And the only thing I would say about the ending was it's funny, but also affecting because, it's set during the Blitz and that caused a lot of damage and a lot of people died that way as well. So it's got it had power to it.
Yeah.
Even though it was obviously a little bit silly as well, but I really enjoyed it all the way through.
That ending, so like they're all standing around, and if you haven't seen this episode, skip past this part and go watch it because it's just, I don't even know what is happening. So when James, you're like, oh yeah, there's comfort there because you know what's going to happen. But did you really know that they were all going to be huddled there in that boxing ring and they're going to be like, well, I saw Patty and I saw Patty too. Well, I never saw Patty.
No.
That's exactly what happened.
I think what I expected was the haunted, seeing the specter of another dead boxer. No, you've got me on that one. I didn't expect the very, very impact.
Because I just went, what? Just like that. Literally went just like that. And then I was like, what? I can't believe that just happened. And then John Lennon shows up again and he's like,
"I,
if you see Patty."
I love that moment where, the one guy goes, I don't see him. And for a second I thought, wait a minute, did I miss something? Why is one person not seeing him? And then I was like, oh, that's right. Okay, yes, all right. I thought, so let's work that out, Mr. John Newland, blowing everything up. And he did.
So this is like, I think a really good example of the kind of stuff that was coming out of One Step Beyond at the time. And it's interesting because the pilot, which I can only vaguely remember now, but it's got Bride in the title. When they revamped the show in the 70s, they redid that episode. I think that was the pilot for the 78 episode, or 70, late 70s episode. And John Newland came back as the host, and he was much older then. And so they had him in like khakis. I don't know if you remember in the 70s, lots of dudes were like, they looked like they were game hunting. They were just like cool old guys.
They were just old guys. Yeah.
They were just old guys. And so he's in like his cool game. Not that I approve of game hunting, but he's like in game hunting gear and with his gray hair and looking at every bit as beautiful as he looked in the 60s. And so I don't know. Do we want to add anything to this?
I've said pretty much all I had to say about that one.
Yeah, I think so too. I love the horror anthologies, and I am ashamed secretly and now in front of everyone that I've never watched the One Step Beyond before 2 days ago.
Let it all out, Dan. Let it all out. So, let me give you just a little bit of background. Again, this aired January 10th, 1961 on ABC. It ran against The Gary Moore Show, which I think was like a variety show. And then on NBC was what I said earlier, Best of the Post, which was some kind of, so NBC had a series of specials that ran in the same time slot against One Step Beyond. And the night that they aired this particular episode, NBC aired a Best of the Post episode titled Valley of the Blue Mountain. I'm guessing it's an anthology show, but I don't know anything about it. And as I mentioned earlier, Bronson had already played a boxer in a program that aired just 2 days before this aired. So he was typecast as a boxer quite often. So for the Twilight Zone intersection here that I thought was really interesting, and God bless somebody on YouTube for mentioning this. It's also on the IMDb page. So in the manager's office of this episode is a fight poster promoting Bully Jackson. A year earlier, Ivan Dixon portrayed Bully Jackson in the Twilight Zone
Yes.
episode, A Big Tall
Tall
Wish.
wish, yes.
Yeah. And so I think it's important to remember, it's not important for this, but it's important to remember that Newland and Serling were friends, and that there's been a lot of hearsay about One Step Beyond kind of ripping off Twilight Zone, even though it came first. And Serling came to Newland about doing his show, but they were actually really good friends. And I feel like Charles Beaumont actually might have written for One Step Beyond at some point too. So there's a little bit of intersection between those two shows, but they're really not at all alike. So anybody listening,
No.
if you're really into Twilight Zone and you're thinking that's what you're going to get, it's not going to happen.
This is sort of more straightforward. Just it wants to get you and make you feel a little ooh, whereas Twilight Zone would do that, but it was also the social commentary and stuff
Yeah,
there.
it
So.
was heavily steeped in that. And so this is not trying to do that. This is just a half hour entertainment, and it's really great. And if you're into that, definitely see it. And this episode is a good place to start. And then let's go on to our big TV movie. We decided to cover a movie from 1993, which is a really interesting decade for TV movies for me. And it was a movie that Bronson made called Donato and Daughter.
She's a policewoman on the most sensational case of her career.
You think this is the work of a serial killer?
Yes.
Her father's a cop whose job is on the line.
When you're in this case, Donato, you need this as much as I do.
Together, they'll risk everything to save a city gripped with fear.
I don't want you to win.
Not your cause, Sergeant. It's mine.
Charles Bronson, Emmy Award winner Dana Delaney, in a spellbinding thriller.
He came after my son.
He knows exactly what he's doing.
Donato! Donato and Daughter, next Tuesday. Due to some violent content, parental discretion is advised.
We are in Los Angeles, and there is someone, a serial killer, is killing in very unpleasant ways nuns. And Charles Bronson plays Donato. I believe he's like Detective Sergeant Donato, who is assigned to a task force by the police chief to find this guy, presumably, and get him off the streets. The tricky thing is that he's put on the task force with his daughter, Dina. I was going to say Dana. But
Oh,
his
yeah,
daughter
sorry.
Dina. And the tricky thing after that is that Dina is actually his boss. Oh, she's a lieutenant, he's a sergeant, and they don't get on together. So I'm making this sound like it's a hilarious comedy, which I thought it was when I first read the plot breakdown, but it's actually a rather dark at times sort of serial killer police procedural. But that's the basic premise. Donato and daughter, with her in charge, are tasked to find this man before he kills another nun. And will they catch him or her? Will they catch them? Will something more sinister happen? I'm going to leave it right there. Donato and daughter.
Tonight on ABC, Donato and
And
Daughter, the quirky comedy of two
could have been a
cops. I
it
can.
could have been a series, I think.
It could have been, yeah. And that's why I thought it was attached to Family of Cops, because it's like Donato and Daughter. I mean, how many of these cop freaking family things has he done? Well, a bunch, it turns out, right? And so it's kind of funny. So I'll go last on this one. James, what did you think of Donato and Daughter?
Yeah, very much enjoyed this, and yeah, thank you for pointing me in the direction of all of these examples. But especially this one, I enjoyed it very much. It was like a cross between his canon films and Family of Cops, is the way I think you'd kind of. It's like a bridge between those two things, really. But it's far harder than I expected. Gorier, the opening scene where they find the nun's corpse, and there's a couple of other corpses that you see. You don't really see much on screen violence, but far harder than I expected. There's a jar of fingers at one point and stuff like that. So there's, you know, you the, they didn't shy away from showing it when they needed to. And I just thought it was really good, mostly because of the performances. And I thought Bronson's fantastic here. I think he's really plays it in a really sensitive way. Alongside, again, I didn't know this actor, Dana Delaney, or Dana yeah. Delaney.
Mm-hmm. Dana.
Thought she was fantastic. Thought she's really brought, you know, really a real gravitas to it. She seemed really down to earth. And, you know, this could have been a big film, I think, in the early 90s. You know, if they'd have done this as a theatrical release. I very much enjoyed it. I like the quietness of it. I like the fact that there's traffic noise in some of the conversations that they're having. I like the fact that it's, you know, very kind of low key. And it's got some really great street scenes as well where they're shooting on location, which I really enjoyed. And as soon as you see Xander Berkeley's name in the credits, well, you know who you know who's done it, right? But that was good because I like him, so I was looking forward to seeing him appearing on screen, and he's great in it. You know, he's great in it as well. He's as good as ever. You know, he's great whenever he's on screen. So very much enjoyed this one, and yeah, thanks for pointing it in my direction.
I'm actually kicking myself. I guess I assumed everybody would know who Dana Delaney is because she was so famous in the 90s for starring on a TV show called China Beach.
Yeah.
This was a big deal for her because I don't remember when she left China Beach or when the show got canceled, but she was still riding high off the fame of that and starting to work in other projects and making her name for herself outside of that series. But here in the States, I didn't watch China Beach, but it was huge. It was huge. And it made stars out of like all the women on that show. Mark Helgenberger, I believe, came off of that as well. I mean, really remarkable actresses. And that was her probably big breakout. But for me, I know her best for starring in one of my favorite Magnum PI episodes. It's a two-parter titled L.A., and she plays Tom Selleck's love interest in that. And it's where he comes out to LA and she's a lawyer and he's got to serve papers or something like that. And they end up having this like really great romance in the midst of this crime. She appears in one more episode. She comes to Hawaii to visit him. I think the episode's called Out of Sync with Lisa Blount. It's so good. And she was this one of my favorite girlfriends of Thomas Sullivan Magnum's. And so I guess I just assumed everybody knew her, but you picked out, I think, one of her finest qualities of her presence is that she is very down to earth. She has she's beautiful. Like whenever Dana Delaney's on screen, I forget it. I don't want to look at anything else. Yeah, yeah, she's just stunning. And her hair, oh my God, the color of her hair. How do you get that color? I want it. But she's also very approachable, like Tom Selleck. So in a way, they were like a perfect love interest couple on that particular Magnum. Because what I like so much about Tom Selleck is he looks like Tom Selleck, but I also feel like I could go next door and knock on his door and be like, hey, you want to get a beer? You know, and Dana Delaney has that same quality to her that I feel like she's really stunning, but also like I want to be her friend. You know,
she's perfectly cast in this for that reason. Sorry to interrupt you and talk over you. I didn't mean to do that.
That's okay.
But she's perfectly cast in this. You know, she really, you know, you believe she's a cop. This isn't she doesn't look like a performance in that she's playing a cop who's got a hardness to her and a steel to her. She really brings that across. And really, I really love the scenes between her and Charles Bronson when she calls him sergeant rather than dad. Those are always good moments.
Donato!
Yeah. She did, yeah. When she called him out for him at the end, she actually yelled out Donato and not dad, and that really
stuck to me. Yes, there she does. Yeah, that's really, really interesting. And then there's a great moment, obviously, when she says to him, because her brother has died, and you know, do you ever wish it was me who died which is a really fantastic moment. And Bronson's acting there is great, and it leads to that really good climax on the roof, which is very similar to the end scene in 10 to Midnight.
Yeah, there's a lot of similarities I feel like we could draw between the two films for sure. Mm-hmm. Thoughts?
If you want to finish, Amanda, you were halfway through your thoughts.
I don't think I have much else to say. I just didn't think about Dana Delaney not being famous to somebody because she's been in my life for so long. You know, even though I didn't watch China Beach, everybody knew who she was. And then she would just show up in all these things. She was in Exit to Eden, which I remember was a big deal because the movie was a flop. But she's so beautiful in it. And
she is gorgeous.
Oh, my God. Yeah. And she's great in it, too. She's great in it. And she kind of saves the film. Her and David Bowie's wife, Iman, is in it.
Oh, yeah.
She's great. Oh, God, yeah. She's fabulous in it. But it was just funny when you said that you hadn't seen the actress before because I was like, what? Because she's really famous, James, and how could you not have heard of her? But anyway, Dan, what did you think of Donato and Daughter?
I really enjoyed it. I think it's an excellent police procedural with that just little extra the family element. When it started, when I read the initial break, that thing of, you know, it, but she's his boss, and I thought, oh dear, was this like we're in like Cop and a Half, Stomp for My Mom Will Shoot, Turner and Hooch category? I don't know where we are, but the fact that I saw, and I'm sure you'll mention it, that it was a Jack Early, based off a Jack Early novel, I was okay, I know who that is. Not to say that Jack Early novels are the height of literature, but the few I've encountered, and there are a bunch of them under, I won't say more, but they're solid police procedural novels. And so they always, and when you do a novel, there's so much you have to write that you have to add all these extra bits that you wouldn't write if you were doing a screenplay. So you get things like the precinct is in a constant state of construction, which I'm sure in the novel was more of a pressing thing. Like she's just going, daughter is going into work, Dina is going into work, but there's this constant like drilling and construction, and they're trying to get their job done, and there's so much noise. It's less emphasized in the movie, and it kind of fades away by the end, but that's sort of one of, to me, one of those very novelistic sort of things that you'd add to get a reader to sort of more have it in their heads, like this is really pushing down on them, that it's like, oh gosh, now they're on top of, and they're painting today, and it's, you know, and the fumes, you know, just that mixed with all the family stuff, and also the woman who gets spoiled, the woman who gets shot, who was apparently romantically involved with the brother, I think,
at some point. Yeah,
that's, yes, right. And so that's one of those, it's interesting because it was based on a novel, I feel the script is richer than a normal procedural. I mean, I'm not a huge Law and Order fan, but I've seen, as most people have, I've probably seen 10 episodes of Law and Order, not meaning to sometimes, but they're just on. And you watch them, and they come on and they do their procedural thing, then they do their court thing, and they do, and it's all, there's not a lot of meat to it. It's very much a binging kind of thing. This is, I think the story and everything that's going on is sort of thicker. I don't know that that's quite the word I want to use, but there's more to it than that. And you can really feel the family dynamic, and you could feel like when the mom talks to him and when the mom talks to her, you could feel it. And when the killer is getting close to her family and her son, it's a little richer. It's a little stronger, I think. And, I'm not saying this is like the best movie of 93 or 94, whatever it was that came out, but I think it's having never heard of it until you proposed that we should watch it, I thought it was pretty darn good, and it moves nicely, and the killer is creepy, and there's a great scene where Charles Bronson's character goes to Arizona to investigate the killer's background, which is, it reminded me of the non-comedic version of the scene in Fletch, where Fletch goes to investigate the bad guy, and he pretends to be Harry Truman, and he's talking to the parents of the bad. It was like the non-comedic version of that. And I really thought it was good. There were a few moments here and there where I felt like maybe they trimmed maybe a bit too much, like with the construction that just sort of fades away. I felt like maybe that didn't develop the way it should have, but overall it works and it moves and it's emotional and it's creepy and it's exciting and in the end it's satisfying. And the ending scene, the ending tracking helicopter shot with the two of them are walking along a roof, and spoiler, as they're having this discussion, like, so what are you doing? And they're having this fun discussion. In the background the whole time is the dead body of the killer with like 6 bullets in his chest. And it's a hilarious shot. But it's, I think overall, it's a really sharp movie. And I really enjoyed it.
I think the film has earned that ending, right? Because it juggles all those things really well. It's high quality, actually. It's a high quality piece of work. I was expecting it to be far, I don't know. not trashier, but I think what Danny was saying, a lot lighter than it was, and a lot less meaty, right? And I think you've got right. It is there's a lot of material here, and the film balances it really well, and it doesn't drag. And I could easily watch it again. I mean, I could put it on now and have no problem watching it from beginning to end, right? And I only watched it yesterday, so it's a really strong piece of work, actually. Really strong scenes. And that's, you know, you've got, when you've got a great cast and good locations, and you know you're making it on location, and a plot where you're willing to show, you know, some dark stuff, you know, it really does it shows what film is capable of. It's a high quality TV movie. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, good. One thing I wanted to mention, you guys are both kind of talking about, well, I guess you talked about it more, James, just now. You're sort of talking about how it's shot on location, and so just my quick opinion of it. I really enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun. I did not get bored at all watching it. But one of the things that I loved about it was that, and Dan can probably attest to this, is that's not what LA really looks like. That is one small section of Los Angeles made to look really freaking urban and gritty. And downtown does have some grittiness to it, but nobody lives downtown like that, no, you know, or didn't really. Then. They created like this really interesting universe that is nothing like my experience of living there. And and I loved it. I loved where they shot it. And they shot it downtown because there's parts where they're actually on the streets and you can see. So one of the things about downtown is like that they sort of lied in the movie is that once 10 o'clock hits, everything closes down. It's just a barren wasteland. And all those like, I don't know what you call those, but like those kind of garage door closings go over all the business fronts and lock down. And there used to be a theater down there, the Orpheum. And the Orpheum used to have movie marathons for Halloween, and I would go every year. The thing is that the marathons would run till like 2 or 3 in the morning, but after 10, there was nowhere to go in between the films to get something to eat because everything was locked down and there was no businesses existed and there was nobody on the streets, not even really homeless people. Like, it just closed down. And I thought it was so interesting that Bronson's character lives in an apartment because there's nobody lives in an apartment like that in Los Angeles downtown. Nobody. And it felt like they were New York or Chicago. And I love that.
It
was such a neat like aesthetic. And they shot, so Xander Berkeley, where his character works, was the Bradbury Building, which is a very famous building in Los Angeles downtown. And it's beautiful. And they have a couple of old buildings like that downtown. The library, the downtown library, is magnificent. And so they chose the locations really well. Like when they were mapping out where they were going to shoot stuff, they did a really good job creating this kind of alternative universe to LA. And I like that they tried to stay away from the sort of glamorous side of LA and like the Palm Beach. Like, she lives on the beach, but it doesn't feel like the way I'm used to seeing the beach in films and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
It's just, and she's only there for a brief moment before she moves in with her dad. But like, it, I was really taken with the photography of it. And I was thinking about it because, so Dan's been with me here for a while now, and we've only watched a handful of movies from the 90s, but one of them was Death of a Cheerleader. Mm-hmm. And I remember Dan saying, oh man, like the camera shots were just really like, I don't know what the phrase you use, but they were really super economical. And there were things that they were, it just, it wasn't, it felt like a TV movie. It didn't have any kind of cinematic aspect to it.
Yeah. I remember that. Yeah.
And TV movies can be like that. And in the 90s, there was this fine line of TV movies. There were some that seemed to be able, I don't know if they just had different budgets or what, but some of them had way more cinematic flavor to them, like Donato and Daughter, and then some of them look like Death of a Cheerleader, you know, and they look like a TV movie. They have like these trademark camera shots, and there's not a lot of flourish to them. This movie is like all flourish, you know, and so it's such an interesting anomaly to me. And there's other TV movies from the 90s that look like that, but this one really felt cinematic. And I don't know if it's because Bronson was there, and maybe bringing him on allowed them to spend more money, like they got more. I don't really know the story behind it, but I know it does look slightly different than other TV movies of this era.
I don't know if I've probably already given away who the killer was, and I won't say it again. But there's a moment where one of the characters gets killed late on in the film in an apartment, and there's a tracking shot that kind of tracks away from it across the apartment. It's about 5 to 10 minutes from the end, And it's really sophisticated. It's really unmotivated camera work, but really shows that stylistic flourish. The director is really, it's not just shooting for economy here. It's shooting to create an actual mood, right? And using the camera in an expressionistic way. So there's some really beautiful camera work and camera movements, as you say. It's high quality. It's cinema quality, right? That's the level that it has. This could have been released theatrically. No problem, and no one would know the difference.
Yeah, I agree. It definitely has like a flavor to it that you didn't see as much in the 90s and some 70s TV movies. I guess it just depended, but it stands out because of that to me. And then in just terms of the film itself, I really liked it. It's just really well paced. I love all the actors that are in it. It helps to have people like Charles Bronson and Dana Delaney in anything, and Xander Berkeley. So funny Xander Berkeley story. When I lived in LA, I ran into him on the street. I was walking somewhere and he was walking past me, and it was clear that I recognized him, right? Because my eyes got really big, and he saw me, and he made this face kind of like, oh, she recognizes who I am. And I know he's been in so many great things, and I know he's running through the roster of all these films he's made in his head. And I'm like, dude, you were in Poison Ivy too. Which is like the best movie ever. And I didn't say that to him. We just passed each other in the street. And it didn't even occur to me till later. And I would say, you know, I'd be watching TV and he'd show up in something. And I'm like, oh my God, this guy's been in so much stuff. I feel like such a heel. Mm-hmm. Like that was the first thing. Thank God I didn't say anything, right? So like when I met Larry Drake, who's in Dark Knight of the Scarecrow, I was like, you're Dr. Giggles. You're Dr. Giggles. Now, of course, I was really drunk. And I walked up to his table and I said that. And he was not that interested in talking to me. But, and you know what I mean? So luckily I didn't do that with Xander Berkeley, but like, it's so funny because, he usually plays these kind of sleazy characters and he's really good. I don't think he's a sleazy person, but boy, he plays it well.
Yeah.
He's good at it.
So really I love the scene, you know, just so I don't forget saying that scene on the roof where you've got the friend who's pregnant, the other cop who's pregnant. That's such a great scene. And there's, it's interesting, they've got two rooftop shootout chases, which you don't often get two separate ones in the film. No, it really leads to it's really good drama, and it's a bit hokey. She just announced that she's pregnant, and you know, lo and behold, she's shot in the next scene. But it does affect you, and I think that actress is she's been in Lethal Weapon 2. I think I recognised her from that. She was one of the cops in Lethal Weapon 2, and I thought she played it quite well in quite a small role as well. I'm going to try and find her name.
I have it.
Weeks. Is it something like that?
Oh, no. That's Kim Weeks is the girl.
Xander
Berkeley's wife.
The wife. Yes, sorry.
Yeah, Jeanette Goldstein is the actress's name.
That's the one. Yeah, Jeanette Goldstein. Mm. Yeah, she's really good as well.
Well, you know, you have to admit it's really ballsy to shoot a pregnant woman and kill her in anything.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was not expecting that. And I mean, I guess when the gunfight started, I was like, oh, yeah, she's going to get shot. But I wasn't expecting her to get shot in the stomach to die.
I will say the one tricky thing about that scene is the moment she goes into slow motion, I thought she's dead. She's in slow motion. I mean, why is this? And I also think that possibly in the book there, because she says, I'm pregnant. Oh, that's wonderful. And then like 5 minutes later, right in the gut. I feel like maybe in the book there would have been more space there. So when that happens, it was more effect. I mean, it's obviously affecting when it happens, but it's also a bit like, okay, yeah, that we just put a red shirt on you and you are dead.
It's really effective because so Dana Delaney is kind of trying to work her way up, and then they're like, okay, you're going to run this task force, and she's really excited about it until she finds out her dad's on it, right?
And Donato!
But then she makes a really bad mistake because they don't run a check on this supposed suspect before they go after him because they're so desperate to catch the killer at this point. And so through a series of just mishaps, they end up killing a friend of hers who's pregnant. And I like that because it's really dark, you know, because it was a preventable crime. They didn't try to make it easier on the characters by like having like he had an alibi. He couldn't have been there during at least one of the crimes they found out. Right. And so they don't skate around and try to make it like, well, it could have been him. It was just purely bad police work in a lot of ways. And that's great because that adds to the film and it makes it more real because let's face it, police work is a lot about a lot of red tape, right? Mm-hmm. And about like being under pressure of things. And I think that having this sort of mishap happen to the degree that it does kind of shows the sort of pressure that they work under and that these horrible mistakes happen. And then you have to figure out a way to reconcile with them, right? And maybe they don't spend as much time with it, but I kind of feel like Jeanette's character kind of looms over the film in a way because it was sort of shocking to do that to her. So, so I like that aspect of it. And I do like that there's a lot of stuff in there that it feels, I don't know, realistic because I'm obviously not a police officer. I don't know what's realistic about crime fighting, but it gives it a flavor that makes you feel like you're really in it with these people, you know? Mm-hmm. And that was really great. And also, since we're talking about actors we really like, Bonnie Bartlett plays Bronson's wife. And Bonnie Bartlett plays a horrible racist on an episode of The Golden Girls. You see how I remember these people? She was probably like in some Oscar-winning movie, and I'm like, "You're the Golden Girls, and she's a racist." And it was, she's so good at like these really stern kind of roles. Mm-hmm. And I really liked her in this. And one of the things that I thought was so great was that they just casually mentioned that Bronson could have taken over her dad's business.
Yeah, that was interesting.
And
yeah.
that's how you know that they have all this money because their apartment's really nice. And you're like, how is this? How can they afford this? Well, it's her place, right? They bought it with her family's money. And I like this idea of like this rich family who have basically shunned that side. And I don't want to say shunned. I don't think they're ashamed of it. But like they've decided to become cops over probably taking what seemed like a much more comfortable position that would have paid a lot more money. Right. Mm-hmm. And for the good of fighting evil or whatever. And so like there's some really interesting like little things in the film. And I think you're right. Probably in the novel, they've laid all of that out. Right. And so maybe Tommy's death, I think it could have used more impact in the movie.
Makes a little more sense. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that they could have carried it out. Or I think they probably carried it out better in the novel. But there's some really neat little things that are happening all over the place. And so like it's a movie I found is better if you don't casually watch it. It's got a lot of casual quality too because it's beautiful to look at. The acting is good. And on the surface, like I was saying earlier, it looks like all this stuff's happening and that's fine. But then it also has all these little things, you know, that I'm guessing they just took from the novel and sprinkled it in. It adds more to the characters. It gives them some kind of meat, right? And like you guys were saying. And that's one of the aspects of the film that I really like.
It's just as a little kind of coda to that scene on the roof where the pregnant cop gets shot is there. I don't think it's the very next scene, but the next time you see Charles Bronson's character, Donato, he goes to church.
Yes.
And he lights two candles. Mm-hmm. Obviously one for the mother, one for the unborn baby, which was, I thought was a really, really nice touch, you know, like really, again, underlined what had happened and, you know, and in a subtle way, another very good scene.
So let me ask you guys, what did you think about when, okay, so Xander Berkeley's killed a couple people and he's revealed early on, so we're not really revealing anything by saying this. It's clear who the killer is. It's not a whodunit. It's not somebody they know. And actually the trailer or the TV spot makes it look like he might be romancing Dana Delaney. Mm-hmm. And they actually had a relationship, and then we find out he's a serial killer, which clearly doesn't happen in this. And one of the things that Dana Delaney said in interviews about why she wanted to do this film, A, to work with Charles Bronson, but B, she said it was so great to make a movie where she's not in a love story. Mm-hmm. And because you don't see that. Women are always attached to some kind of romance, right? And here she's just a cop working, and she has an ex-husband, but like there's no like, are they,
Gino?
Are they... Yeah, so like it's really cool. But so anyway, so Xander Berkeley's he's taken on to putting on different types of costumes to camouflage himself so that these nuns will let their guards down. And one of them happens to be a cop costume. And he's in downtown LA and this nun walk, there's nuns everywhere. I never saw that many nuns in LA in my life. And they're everywhere. And he walks up to her and he's like, hey, you know, I saw you walking in. I thought I should protect you because of all the stuff that's happening with nuns. And of course she thinks it's a police officer, right? And so she's like, okay. And then she ends up dead in an elevator. So Donato and daughter, being the really smart people that they are, start already thinking, well, maybe he put the body there because he's toying with us and maybe he lives in this building, right? And so anyway, they're going to already do like a, what's that called, where you go up and down and you check all the apartments and close off the building and whatever.
Canvas
and,
the building.
Canvas, I thank you. And I'm out of words today. And so they're canvassing the building and they go to this one guy's house who I believe is supposed to be gay and they're harassing him.
Now, you heard you like to wear costumes.
Do you have some kind of dress-up outfit, like a nun's habit?
I have a cape. I do not have a nun's habit. What is this, Nazi Germany? Are you really allowed to search my apartment without a warrant?
We're not searching your apartment, Mr. Lyle. If I was to search this apartment, you'd really know it. You want us to search the apartment?
Can we see the cape, please?
Again, it reminded me of 10 to Midnight, because they did that, can I use your bathroom? Which happens in 10 to Midnight. and so they can go through his stuff. And, but I felt like they were being, it felt like a scene that might not play as well today. Did you guys have any kind of feelings about that particular scene?
It didn't stand out particularly for me. I can see the point you're making now. I thought the guy was relatively sympathetic, I think. I didn't think that they made him out to be a figure of fun necessarily. And maybe that changed the tone of it slightly. But again, it played into that police procedural aspect of it, and of course, which 10 to Midnight is about. It's about the, you know, it's about sloppy police work, lets the man back out on the streets again, right? And he's like, you know, and you know, it all plays into that. I mean, it just made the thing more morally complex for me, but it didn't stand out as being particularly problematic. But now you mention it, I can see how, yeah, it might play differently today.
Yeah.
Just real quick, I don't think he wasn't sympathetic. I think it was the way they treated him, like when they went to his closet to look at his cape, and they kind of pass this look. You know, and it kind of, it just didn't play right for me, like that aspect of the treatment.
For me, I think that was all played into this idea of the film being harder than I expected, as in like a harder tone. It's not throwing lip service to the audience necessarily. Sure. They're still having to do this really difficult job in difficult circumstances, and maybe not doing it terribly well in some cases. Mm. And I thought that's what I mean. It had that hard edge to it, which I really liked.
I think with that scene for me, I part of it is because it's Donato and daughter, you might, in part of my mind, it's like, well, they're not going to act like, you know, good cop, bad cop, like Freebie and the Bean or something. But they sort of do. They go
they
in
do.
There. They're kind of a little rough to the guy. But to me, I like that guy because he reminded me of, there's a guy earlier in the movie who talks about his sister who is a nun. And he's like, and he's this very shaky guy up on a roof, like feeding birds or something. I don't know what he's doing. And it's like, I went out for a walk. Well, how long did you go to? How long was the walk? It was like a half an hour. Was it a half hour? It's a half an hour. It was an hour and a half. I don't know. We just went out for a walk.
You want to know how long the walk was?
Yes.
Half an hour? Hour and a half? 2 hours?
Bert, you don't win anything. Only you know the answer.
It's weird because that guy and the guy in the apartment there with his costumes and things almost reminded me of like an early 70s giallo, like a bird with a crystal plumage sort of character. You know, those weird characters that they would come across in a giallo who aren't the killers, but are just kind of this, you know, I'm a little weird. You guys are a little weird, you know, and in cop, the world of the cops, you probably walk into slightly weird places all the time. And to me, it's sort of like seeing him was sort of like, oh, it's like that guy with the nun. He's sort of just like, he's doing his own thing and he's living his life. And these two straight laced cops walk in and are maybe a bit judgy about the way he lives his life, but they shouldn't be, but they are trying to catch a killer. And there was a dead nun in your elevator. So, you know, so it didn't bother me, but I, like you said, I could see someone watching and being a bit like, I think they're treating him a bit too rough, possibly. Maybe.
Is it okay if we rename the movie Dead Nun in an Elevator?
Let's do it. They got two titles already, and the third one hurt.
The Blu-ray release will be Dead Nun in an Elevator, and you can watch it with dead women in laundry.
Isn't that a giallo? It's like Dead Nun in Elevator, La Lifto. The one thing that guy does that I absolutely love and is one of my favorite moments is when Dina looks at him, and says, you may want to contact your lawyer. And he looks at her and says, what I would say, and what I think a lot of people would say, I don't have a lawyer, which I absolutely love, because you're always getting that, these things where it's like, it's time to contact your lawyer. And everyone across the board is like, okay. But if you said that to me, I'd be like, I don't know. You got a card for Perry Mason? I don't know. Matlock around? I don't know. So I think it's an interesting scene, and I like that guy.
Yeah, I like him too. I was just curious about if we felt like in today's, I don't know, lens, if we would see it differently. But apparently I'm just a social justice warrior. I can't help it. It's what I do. So, so this was a really neat film. And one, I really am angry at myself that I've had it for. I have tons of movies, though, that I haven't watched yet. But, like, it's just been sitting there on VHS. And I've been like, I should watch this. And then I just haven't. So it was nice to have an excuse to get this out. And it's really inspired me to check out Family of Cops, which I think was the last things Bronson might have done before he retired. I can't remember offhand now. Yes, it is. He did Family of Cops 1, 2, and 3, and that was it. And Death Wish
5.
5 was between Donato and Daughter and the first Family of Cops movie.
Yay.
I like Death Wish 5. It's better than people say it is.
Yes, it is. It is.
But yeah, so this was really good. I don't know. Do we have anything else we want to add to it?
Do you know much about how it was? Well, I'm sure you're going to go through it now. How it went down, how it was reviewed, whether it got good audience figures?
Yeah, I have all of that. I can do the background here. I will tell you before I dive into it, there was not a ton of promotion for this film, and that really surprised me, because I thought, well, Bronson's in a movie. It would be really big, right? TV movie. And there was very little press that I could find attached to it. But I did find a couple things. I am going to post it. He did an interview on the set that somebody put up on YouTube, and I'll probably try to put some clips of that, if not the whole thing, on this recording, because it's a pretty great interview. And I will mention something, a really neat piece of trivia about this film at the end. But so this was Donato and Daughter aired on September 21st, 1993. It aired on CBS. It was shot in downtown LA, as we mentioned, and a lot of the interiors were shot at the Bradbury Building. And if you've never seen the Bradbury Building, just look for the scenes where Xander Berkeley's in his office. It's just a stunning building. It ran against on ABC Roseanne, Coach, and the premiere of NYPD Blue, which is important because, that show was huge when it came out, because it was going to have nudity and a little bit more violence. And I remember watching the premiere for NYPD Blue, so I clearly did not watch Donato and Daughter when it originally aired. It didn't get huge ratings, though, and I mean NYPD Blue. It got a 15-plus rating, which is not huge. I think at the time, the highest rated show was getting a 23. And then on NBC, it ran against the John Larroquette show, a sitcom called Second Half, and a new show that NBC used to have called NBC Dateline. Donato and Daughter only got a 14.8/24, which is like less than NYPD Blue, and much less than Roseanne and Coach. I think it ended up at number 45 out of 94 programs, so somewhere in the middle. So it was middling. It did rerun in May of 1995, and it got a 9.4/16. And as Dan mentioned, it was based on Jack Early's novel from 1988. The only real reviews I could find were from the LA Times and Variety. The LA Times said that the relationship angle was weak, but the suspense was good. John Matsumoto of the LA Times wrote, quote, the problems with Donato and Daughter is that it never exhibits the type of sensitivity or insight necessary to fully convey the inner thoughts and feelings of this uncommunicative pair, end quote. But he did really like Xander Berkeley. He basically called him cool as a cucumber psychopath, and he thought that he really livened up the film. Variety wrote, quote, Charles Bronson's craggy mug and several flavorful supporting performances, including the cadavers, prop up this otherwise formulaic suspense thriller about a cop/daughter-led task force investigating a serial killer with a deadly thing for nuns. And that was really all I could find. And I was really surprised. Really surprised. One thing I will note is that one of the reviewers, and I think it might have been the guy from the LA Times, thought that the directing was really poor. And it's interesting that James, one of the first things he brought out was how well Rod Holcomb put the film together.
yeah.
So it's kind of difference of opinion there. So Holcomb.
It could be that I've got no taste.
No, I don't think that's it. Because I do think he puts the movie really, especially for a TV movie. I mean, you can compare it. If you ever get a chance to watch Death of a Cheerleader, I mean, you'll just see visually how different the two films are. And they're only a year apart. So Rod Holcomb, the director, was primarily an episodic director. But in the 1990s, he ended up almost directing nothing but TV movies. He did things like A Promise to Keep, Angel Street, and Convict Cowboy, none of which I've seen, all of which I want to watch. So Xander Berkeley's first film is, I think, one of his most famous. He was in Mommy Dearest. You might remember he plays Joan Crawford's son. He was in Candyman, which I totally forgot. And when I was passing by on the street, totally forgot. And then I made a note here where I wrote, I remember him best from Poison Ivy 2. And then I put a little smiley face because I love that movie. So Delaney took the part so she could work with Bronson. And as I said, she called him a tough nut to crack. But she said that once... she got him talking and warmed up. He warmed up to her, that he turned out to be a very sweet and funny man. And she really enjoyed working with him. And as I said, she was drawn to the family drama, but also not having a love story. And at this time, Dana Delaney was really making a name for herself. And she had actually signed a contract to begin producing TV movies. Hmm. But she wouldn't end up producing anything until the early 2000s, when she produced two TV movies. One called Final Jeopardy from 2001, which she also stars in, and another one from 2003 called Open House. And of course, after production wrapped on this, Bronson headed directly into Death Wish 5. What I thought was really funny is that the year after this aired, in 1994, Donato and Daughter got an R rating through the MPAA. So I'm mentioning this for a couple different reasons. One, this kind of coincides with James talking about that it's got a hard edge to it, unless they've added something to it. And two, I guess it must have had some kind of theatrical release somewhere for it to even bother to go through the MPAA, unless it had to have a rating to go on home video. I don't know. But it had its name changed. I'm sorry, if you can hear that rustling, that's my rats. Sorry, they slept until like 5 minutes ago. So they changed the name of the movie to Dead to Rights in 1998, and that's when it came out in on home video. That's the copy I have, and that's really all the background I have. And I was shocked. I thought for sure I would plug this into my archival resources and I would get all kinds of stuff about this film just because Bronson was in it and it was a TV movie, but that wasn't to happen. I kind of think the Seawolf, which he made around the same time, kind of took some of the press away, because it was made for TNT, and at the time, TNT, the basic cable channels were really putting a lot of money into their TV movies, and they were really big films, and the Seawolf was based off of a Jack London novel, and so I think it just had more cachet, and probably all the attention went to that film, and then he made this, and they were like, oh look, he made a movie for CBS, and also he did, as I mentioned earlier at the beginning of this, he did a movie called a remake of Yes, Virginia, There Is a Santa Claus, and I think he did that after Jill Ireland died, and so that took some more of the press away. So I think this film kind of just came out after, when I think people were paying more attention to his TV work. That's my personal thought on it. So that's what I could find on it. I'm glad we all liked it. I guess we would recommend all of these. If you were going to recommend one of these three things we watched to people listening, what would you recommend, James?
I think you have a pretty good time with Donato and Daughter, really. I think it's really watchable. And I think it's it'll be a good evening, a really good 90 minutes. But if you're in the mood for curious, more odd pieces, then definitely the One Step Beyond episode.
Dan?
I think I'm going to go with Donato and Daughter too. And actually, I just found out, do you know any more about Jack Early?
No.
Jack Early is actually a woman named Sandra Scopitone.
Oh.
Who's written 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, about 20 novels. And written three under the name Jack Early. I did not know that.
The
name was bothering me. And I thought, I know that name. But yeah, so Jack Early is a writer named Sandra Scapitone? I don't know. But I would say of the three things here, I think Donato and Daughter is a lot of fun. I think if you like your anthologies, well, One Step Beyond is probably going to be great. I haven't seen them all yet, but I think it's going to be great. And Man with the Camera is, I think if you watch a bunch of them, it will accumulate and be pretty darn fun. But just watching one was a bit insubstantial. So I would go with Donato and Daughter.
Cool. Yeah, I'm going to go with the One Step Beyond episode because I think it's a pretty good entry point into what the series was trying to do. And because for me, even though I enjoyed all three of these, it's the performance for me that I think really stands out. And it's kind of different from, I think, how we're used to seeing Bronson. And so I think that people might get a treat watching that. So there you go. We all hated Man with the Camera. We all hated it.
No.
So there you go. And so this was our little tribute to Bronson. It had some rocky waves there, so I'm sorry about that. I think before we go, let's all just kind of catch everybody up with what we've been doing. So James, tell us a little bit about where we can find you and what you're working on and if you have any new podcast episodes.
Yeah, so my podcast, Newton Talks, is still producing episodes, and people can go on and find that online. They can find it through my website. I don't know if you're putting a link to it on your website, so
yeah.
they can check it through that. And then through that, you'll find a link to my website, which I'll have a link to my Vimeo and my YouTube, so you can check out some of the films that I've done and some of the writing that I've done on my website as well. So. Just go through the link and see what you can find.
Awesome. Dan, what are you up to?
Adventure Super Train is around 100 and episode 114 or so. We're still talking Search with Mitchell, Kolchak with Tim, and the Kolchak just came out on Blu-ray, and I know a lady, I forget her name, who did a commentary or two on the Kolchak Blu-ray set. I'll have to look her name up. I don't remember. Oh, Donato, I think was her last name.
Yeah, I think it might be.
But we're doing Kolchak on there. And Amy the Conqueror and I might be at the end of our Planet of the Apes chat by the time this goes up, and you might be hearing a new show. But that's going along. And Happy Days is in between season 5 and 6, my Rockin' All Week with You. And the Minute by Minutes, the 3 Minute by Minutes I'm doing, we're almost a half an hour into the 3 70s Friends of Frankenstein, Spooky Minutes Spent in a Ghost House, and Howling 2 and 7-2. So that's where we are. Oh, and buy my book, From Beverly Hills to Hooterville, Exploring the Henningverse. Go on Amazon, buy 2 copies. Then there you can have a fight with a friend and you can hit each other with, I don't know. It's been a long episode.
Yeah, I know. It's been something crazy. So, and that made my head spin, all that stuff you're doing. I'm like at episode 4 of the Trapcast, and it's ridiculous. but I'm hoping things will quiet down. I say that every episode, and then something happens. But so just briefly, here's what I've been doing since we last spoke. It's. I'll just go through really quickly. I did a lot of commentaries at the beginning of the year that are just now coming out, and some of them will be of interest to the listeners because they are TV movie related. So I did a commentary for a movie called The Victim, which stars Elizabeth Montgomery, and was, I think, written by Merwin Gerard, who created One Step Beyond. So if you like One Step Beyond or The Victim, you should cross over to the other one. That was a lot of fun for me, and that just came out through Kino Lorber, along with 2 other TV movies, Scream Pretty Peggy and The Screaming Woman. So you can get those 3 together, and they would make a wonderful triple. I also did 3 audio essays for Vinegar Syndrome for their televised terror box set. And I did 3 audio essays, and it was really fun. I recorded that at the beginning of the year during the winter freeze, by the way. And that was a very stressful time for me. And then I ended up doing a commentary for a TV movie called Freedom, which stars Mare Winningham, was written by Barbara Turner, who is the mother of Jennifer Jason Leigh. And this is loosely based on the real story of Barbara Turner's other daughter, Carrie. And it's on a box set called Primetime Panic, also released to Vinegar Syndrome, but through the company Fun City Editions. The other 2 movies are Dreams Don't Die and Death Train to Osaka. And that's a really fabulous box set, and they put a lot of hard work into that, and televised terror. All the transfers look amazing. I did do 2 commentaries for the Kolchak box set, which just came out as of this recording. The commentaries I did were for Amanda Donato did 2 commentaries for the Trevi Collection and Legacy of Terror. That was really fun for me, but I actually had maybe... I don't want to say one thing is better than the other. I love all the projects I worked on, but I did a commentary for a Night Gallery episode, which is coming out in November. Yeah. At the end of November, the episode I did has the two segments, The House and Certain Shadows on the Wall. And I couldn't even tell you how much fun that was for me, because I'm a huge fan of Night Gallery. I know we've been talking a little bit about Rod Serling through this episode, but Night Gallery was my show over Twilight Zone. You know, I just loved it. And the first season was really on fire. There's so many good episodes, and I'm really, really excited to be a part of that set. I also did a commentary that came out last month called Alone in the Dark. It's a horror movie with Jack Palance and Martin Landau and a bunch of other great people. And I did that with Justin Kurzweil of The Hysteria Continues. I did my first video essay with my friend Chris O'Neill. We did it for the Toolbox Murders. And my essay is about how the movie is actually about grief and loss, and how it's a very relatable film for people who've gone through that. I did the liner notes for a Arrow release coming out called My Stepmother's an Alien, which is a Kim Basinger joint that I really liked. I did not write about Kim Basinger in that, but I'm looking for another Kim Basinger movie so I can really cheerlead what a wonderful actress she is. And then finally, Dan and I are on a release together.
Oh, yes.
That's right. I did two things on this. So Arrow is releasing in December, I think, Phantom of the Mall, which is this terrific low-budget horror movie from the late 80s. It takes place in a mall. I wrote about mall culture in the liner notes, and I also did the commentary with my friend Ewan Kant, who is the producer of The Extras. We did the commentary for The Prey when that came out. And Dan wrote the main booklet, part of the booklet, for Phantom of the Mall. And I think there's some mall madness in there too.
Yes, a bit. Yeah.
How could there not be? And and that's what I remember doing that's been announced. I think the best thing to do is follow me at Made for TV Mayhem on Twitter, if anybody wants to keep up with things I'm doing, because I can't remember all of it, to be honest with you. If you want to follow the show on any of our social media, you can find us on Instagram at Made for TV Mayhem. You can find us on Twitter at TV Mayhem Podcast. You can find us on Facebook at the Made for TV Mayhem Show. And you can always email us at tvmayhempodcast@gmail.com. And usually here we tell you what the next episode's going to be, but that would mean I'd have to have programmed the next episode. And I forgot. So we'll figure out what it is. And I'm not sure if this episode's going to air before or after, but I know we had planned on doing a Jeannot Zouark. And apparently I'm saying that wrong, because my friend interviewed him. And
is it like shark? More like
it's Zouark and it rhymes with shark. But I think the Jeannot I'm getting wrong. I'm not really.
Oh, okay.
I think I've just totally butchered this man's name. But we're going to do a double feature of him, which will either have already come out or is coming out again very soon. And I think we decided to do Night of Terror.
Yes, and we're just going to talk about Jaws 2 for 2 hours.
Yeah, we'll talk about Jaws 2. And he also did, I think it's called You'll Never See Me Again is the second
one. Sounds right, yeah.
Yeah, that we're going to do. So, and then we have more guests lined up, so I'm really excited. And a big thank you to James, because he always brings so much to the conversation, but also this show was like it was a clown show. It was a clown show.
I want to thank you both anyway for inviting me on. So it's been really good. I'll tell you what's been really great about it. It's just been, you know, you get to a certain age and you think you've learned about everything you need to learn about. So being confronted by things that I'd never seen before and didn't know much about was really exciting. So I want to thank you both again for that.
Oh, good.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, it's fun for me too, because these are things I hadn't seen any of these to the best of my knowledge or didn't remember anyway. And so it was really great. And anytime you can sandwich Charles Bronson into something for me, I will take that. So that was really good for me, because I just adore him. And I wish he was still here. I know 100 is old, but he brought such presence to film that was so unlike any other actor I can think of. Mm-hmm. And he was really important in my life personally and just in the world of cinema, clearly. And so it was really nice to like look at the things that he did that a lot of people haven't talked a lot about. So thank you both for coming out on here to help me do that. And thank you everybody. If you made it to the end of this, we really appreciate it. And we will talk to you soon. Thanks.
Yeah.
Good night or goodbye.
Goodbye.
Charles Bronson is back in front of the cameras after taking a break because of the illness and death of his wife. On the set of one of his latest projects, he spent a rare moment in front of our cameras with Sherry Sylvester.
I used to come down here when I was in the Air Force over at Kingman, Arizona. And it's all changed. You see that building? That was like a new, on top of you. That building was like new when I first came here.
The buildings around his Los Angeles film set may be showing their age, but the years have been kinder to Charles Bronson, At 71, he can still shoot a high-speed chase and is arguably more energetic than his years younger crew.
Okay, guys, let's stand by to move out here.
Born Charles Buchinski, he worked in the coal mines with his 14 siblings and served as a tail gunner in the Air Force before coming to Hollywood. His toughness played out on screen in films with tough names: Death Wish, Messenger of Death, Assassination. It may come as a surprise, then, that this strong, silent type once roomed with comedian Jack Klugman. Of this truly odd couple, Bronson says Klugman was the slob he later played as the TV character Oscar Madison.
He played the right part. We worked for the New York Post Office for one Christmas, delivering mail in the Puerto Rican section, special delivery. We'd come back, he'd have blisters on his toes, and he'd take his socks off and put them on the radiator so he could dry. You talk about stink.
It's still hanging over a little bit.
Donato and Daughter with Dana Delaney is one of many new projects for Bronson. He has completed Seawolf for TNT and is going to work on Death Wish 5. This after years off spent with wife Jill Ireland before she died of cancer in 1990. You still think about it?
Oh, yeah. All her stuff is still there. Her clothes and makeup and the whole thing is still there. She was far brighter than me. She had many talents, you know. She could paint, sing, act. She does a lot of things. She used to do work on stage and ice skates, roller skates, everything.
Do you think you'll ever remarry?
No way. Not because it was so bad, but because it was so nice, I could never... If I married again, I would be making comparisons. It'd be terrible.
Ireland wrote of her bout with cancer and of her life with Bronson in the bestseller Life Wish, one of three books he has never read.
If things ever get a little dull, then maybe I'll read them, but otherwise I won't. When I say dull, I mean the memory of Jill and those experiences.
Sherry Sylvester, CNN Entertainment News, Hollywood.